it. I don't know.
Good morning. Welcome to the work session for September 20th, 2023. And we're going to begin with the commissioners. And we do have an add-on. And then Commissioner Bacon wishes to say something. So we have two add-ons. And we have a pretty full agenda. So Commissioner Bacon, you want to go first?
Yeah, thanks. I'm a little shaky this morning. I'm grateful to be here alive. I was driving today and drove through Green Bank at the posted speed limit, maybe 2 miles. That's kind of what I do. I drive maybe 2 miles above the speed limit. That's my thing. And I get through there and I'm driving at the speed limit again. And there's a whole bunch of cars coming. And somebody at the back of that line decided they wanted to pass all those cars. And they start coming towards me. And they're like maybe 5 car lengths away, driving very, very fast. And I have my lights on. They should have seen me before they made that decision, right? And so I went happily where I was. This is one of those places on Whidbey Island that has a nice wide shoulder. So I was able to drive into the shoulder and drive the shoulder while this car passed me. And my immediate thought, Janet, was, what if this was Camino? Or one of those other places in Island County where we don't have wide shoulders. And so it's just I'm expressing this because I was just flabbergasted by it. And I'm grateful that I was where I was at. And it's just a reminder for anybody who hears this to just
slow down,
please, or pay attention before you go past cars. Just pay attention.
It's ironic you raise it because I had a call and a probably half an hour conversation with one of the previous members of our planning commission who had somebody pass her on one of our side roads at 70 miles an hour crossing a double yellow line. And she was so upset and so just, what are we going to do? And lowering a speed limit's not going to stop somebody from being, pardon my French, an idiot,
right,
and passing across all of those lines. And it is my wish that people, whether they live here or are visiting here, would be more respectful that this is a community, that we have people, you were driving the speed limit, that people in front of him were
they were driving the speed limit too.
That as a community, we should be just more respectful. But I can't wave a magic wand. I'm sorry you went through that.
Yeah.
Scary.
It's scary, and it was not me.
Yeah, no, I know you wasn't.
Right, it was her.
It's like we're getting in trouble for something. That's probably me.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm sorry about that. We'll start with you then.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. We have an add-on. It's an advisory committee reappointment to the Board of Equalization. Ken Bixler in position 3 is asking for a reappointment. The reason this was an add-on and it's important is that they are beginning to meet, and so that they would like to have a full board of committee members when they meet. So they're asking for reappointment.
What community is Kim from?
He lives in Oak Harbor.
Love it. My only question on this is, if it's a reappointment and it's an add-on, we didn't know that we were going to need to renew the reappointment before we had to make it an add-on. We didn't see that reappointment coming.
I own that due to staffing shortage in our office. Committees have not risen to the top, and we are rectifying that. So we will get on top of that. So it expires the 15th, and so they meet. So by waiting until the 4th, we didn't want to risk affecting any of the decisions or reviews that the Board of Equalization needs.
We're consenting.
Thank you.
Yes, I wanted to make sure that was what you checked. And you are up next on.
I would like to speak to the board regarding the cancellation of 3 upcoming meetings. November 15th for the Washington State Association of Counties. It's a conference that the board attends. It's a week-long meeting. In addition, Christmas is on Monday. So that would mean that our Tuesday meeting, December 26th,
Yeah, I'm not coming.
Okay. And then in addition, January 1st, a Monday. So January 2nd, we're looking at January 2nd. I am asking permission for the auditor to approve the vouchers for the canceled meetings. This will prevent any disruption in payment of vouchers, and the auditor will report at the next available meeting. So it's the same procedure that we did last year.
What's going on that Thanksgiving week?
You have your regular meeting Tuesday. There is COG and IRTPO. We are unsure at this time. They will discuss that if they're going to cancel COG and IRTPO.
Okay. So can you remind me again, really just fast, what the days are? I'm not seeing it written down.
Certainly. November 15th, you'll be at WASAC. And we also need to cancel the 16th. I apologize for work session. And December 26th.
I think you mean November 14th and 15th.
I'm sorry, November 14th and 15th. Mm-hmm. December 26th and January 2nd.
This doesn't require an action. This is just direction informing, doesn't require us to take action.
That is correct.
So are we all good with this?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Jennifer. Next on our agenda, is a discussion about homeless encampments. And I'm a little hesitant to jump into this until we've not been able to reach the sheriff yet this morning. Don't know what's drawn him away. I wonder if you guys want to move something else forward and see him back, or just go ahead and start talking about at least our book of business on our side of the house on what we do to do outreach, but it doesn't allow us to address what we can do in terms of enforcement if we don't have that elected official here. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think there's value to putting out the fact that we have ideas on the table. I think there's also value to putting out the fact that the PA's office says he doesn't care, not he. But that basically they're like, well, if the sheriff isn't going to enforce, we're not going to help you come up with code things. I understand why the PA's office doesn't want to be here, because they don't want to give us legal advice in public. They want to do it behind the scenes. And I get that, because then we can own their recommendations. I am a little bit frustrated.
On his way.
I would hope so.
So he's on his way.
I'm not done talking about how I'm a little bit frustrated that we have tools that we're not using. And I think that that's the first question. Where are we with the tools we have?
I have questions that I think I'm comfortable and don't. I mean, we've talked about our outreach and the programs that Human Services and Public Health does. While he's coming up, I may put Connie on the spot a little bit and ask about when we can maybe talk about parking and those kinds of solutions in the future. Is that possible, Connie? Do you mind if I ask you to come up on that one while we wait for Rick? And I know enforcement's going to be part of that solution. So the board's been trying to figure out whether it's in our right-of-way on our neighborhood streets, how do we deal with when we have abandoned or derelict vehicles on our right-of-ways, and what options may be available? It was interesting in the news yesterday, both Renton, Burien, and I think they mentioned Kitsap County are all struggling with different ordinances. Some of them have been kicked back by the courts already. So just beginning to think about and wonder what's available to us in terms of, or what are the different possibilities your department has even begun to consider around this issue?
So we do already have, the ability for the deputies to tag or investigate abandoned vehicles in the right of way. So that's, off the track. If it's in the traveled way, that's a different thing. They're going to take care of that away right away, because it's a safety issue. If it's outside of the edge line, on the shoulder of the road, they have the authority now to tag junk vehicles. That said, they still have those other laws that, about the Boise case and the Seattle case, that define how the deputies can engage with that. And I'm not going to go into that piece.
Can you help me understand how we were able to put no parking, no camping signs up in some areas of our county? And that was found to be fine and constitutional. And we're not able to do it in other areas of our county. How is it okay on Hill Road, but it's not okay on other roads?
So I think what I heard you said was that it was a codified version. So it's in the code. So we can do that. Any place that the board wants to do that, we can make it no parking. I believe that there are some legal ramifications if people are currently living there. As long as they can go somewhere else, then I think it's not a problem. But I know, again, I'm not going to be the one to give you legal advice.
I'm just trying to understand, if I took my RV to, and I know there are other places, I'm not picking on Hill Road, I just remember Hill Road as the name. If I took my RV to Hill Road and started living there, how is it constitutionally any different? I guess that's a question for legal. I understand we have a code that says you can't do that there. But what we're being told is that you can't prohibit that based on this Ninth Circuit's court decision. We did prohibit it some places. We said you can't do that here. So why wouldn't we just say that you can't live on the side of any road?
Is it a timing issue? Like, we did it before it was an encampment, and so therefore we weren't pulling. I mean, I've thought this through 17 ways from Sunday of, do we do it on our, you know, per your thought? We've had these conversations in open public sessions. So we've talked about arterials. I've thought about no parking, overnight parking. I lived in a town that had no overnight parking unless you had a permit, right? So I've thought about that, so that the residents who wanted to park their boat or their car or their own, because that's where they could get a permit and they can park in the right of way, because it doesn't take away the resident's right to park in front of their own property. I've thought about, do we do it in some major arterials? But then I worried about it getting pushed into neighborhoods, and I don't want to see that happening. To Commissioner Johnson's question, was it because we codified that no parking zone when we codified several others, and we hadn't picked on Hoffman or Taylor or some of these other roads? Is that part of why it was easier to do it there? Can we, after the fact, do it?
Yeah.
Michael?
Michael Jones, County Administrator. My understanding of the Ninth Circuit decision is that you can do it in a wide variety of places. It's when you do it everywhere that you make parking living on the street illegal across the board, then you trigger the issue. There are still lots and lots of places where you can do it. The county has selectively made determinations. There are places where you can't do it. So it's still not illegal to do it in Island County. So we haven't violated that precedent set by the courts.
Is that part of, does anybody know if that's part of what, you know, watching the news and having this be on the news yesterday, is that part of what tripped up a couple of the other counties where they were, you know, no overnight parking or no sleeping ordinances, is because they did it everywhere? Or I don't know, it doesn't matter, it's not relevant to our county. But so you're telling me that we could do what Jill had thought and say no overnight parking in arterials because we're not picking every road in Island County, but we can't do no overnight parking on all county roads? But why is it that I've lived in towns and there are places that do that, and then residents get to get permits? You're not an attorney.
Yeah, I can't answer the second part,
but that's my question.
The places that I know that have been successful in doing it in on all of their streets have provided an alternative. And
mortgage is a solution.
And the alternative is a place where you can go and do that, a place where you, and they call them safe parking typically. So like it's a parking lot that sometimes their churches have done it. City of Vancouver did.
He's been dealt with this morning. Is he still hanging out?
WTA, or excuse me, the City of Vancouver did it with a transit facility that was being that wasn't being utilized. So they create a safe parking place, which has security, which has basic facilities like porta potties, hand washing stations, and then you can't park and camp on the street because we have provided you an alternative. And that has not been challenged as, or that has not been.
Did they provide this? Because I read in one of those news stories that they were going to move it onto county property, a safe place to park, like we've talked about as well, right? Taking a spot. Mm-hmm. And then they were told they couldn't do that because then they couldn't control it because of the Ninth Circuit ruling.
When you say they couldn't control it,
I can't remember which town it was that did this. I was listening to they were just talking in news stories about these different areas. Anyway,
so I don't know. Some of the solutions I'm looking for, and again, I don't want to sound harsh, but I've kind of reached my limit of frustration in this particular instance. Right, we've gone out there, we've tried to stabilize, we've provided resources. The problem's exasperating, and here is my real issue: it's not that this is happening. I understand that there are people who don't have resources. And I understand that there are people with behavioral health issues.
Yeah.
And in both those situations, I want to make sure that we are a compassionate community. Where my line and limit is it's been too long, too consolidated in one area. So we need to find a way to disperse the population around, to not create encampments, right? Two people together is not going to break any community. 23 people for 2 years is. And we need, I'm not mad at you. I am mad about this situation. And honestly, I agreed. I'll be honest. I agreed with Greg. You can't give legal advice at the table, but it is literally frustrating that we're going to have to go behind closed doors to talk about possible solutions. And that feels a little disingenuous to the public. But that's what we're going to have to do. I don't understand why we can't limit the number of vehicles in a location. I don't understand why we can't time limit the amount of time somebody stays mm-hmm. in a location. I know that we have limited housing options, but every member of this community, and I'll say it on the record so that someone can put it on Facebook, that every member of the community deserves to be able to support this population at some point, or should not deserve. Everybody should feel responsible enough to say, yep, that it could happen in my neighborhood for a period of time. And then and then the population moves on someplace else. Because that's where we are in society, right? But what I cannot understand is how this continues to happen in this location for this period of time. And we cannot do anything about it. I'm not saying you can't live this way. I'm saying you can't live this way for 2 years with 23 other RVs and stolen cars and stolen bikes and obvious drug use. I mean, I drive by it. When you're dancing in the street without any clothes on, you're high, right? You're high, Sheriff. Can we get more patrols? Can we tag the vehicles and just deal with it? I understand that the people are going to pop up somewhere else, but we got to get them moving.
A code that said, you know, limited to a particular number, whatever that number is. I would support that. I would support a code that says you can't stay on the highway or on the road for more than a certain number of days at a particular location, so they would have to go move to a different location. I would support that. But then it goes into enforcement. If we pass something like that, Sheriff, what would the challenges be for you for enforcement? I would absolutely support both of those things.
Well, first of all, I apologize for not being in the beginning of this conversation, so I don't know what you've covered.
We haven't covered anything. We've been waiting for you.
I hope the board is aware that we are diligently working on a plan to at least clean up the mess up there in Hoffman Road. And I honestly don't think that most people in the community have an issue with you pulling over in your RV and spending the night on a turnout in the county. Mm-hmm. What people have an issue with is destroying the entire area as a lifestyle.
Right.
And quite honestly, I'm at the end of my rope with this particular group of people, because we have offered everything we have to offer to try to help. And there's been not one that I'm aware of follow up for, you know, housing assistance or mental health assistance or substance abuse treatment, any of those sorts of things.
Not one that's taken advantage of what's been offered.
Right. Nobody said, hey, I need your help. There are one or two people who are working in that direction. Addiction is what it is. It's a painfully slow process. So all of that aside, I think as a state and as a culture, and it trickles into Island County, we sort of got wrapped around the axle in this Boise decision and the Long decision in Seattle. And all of a sudden we got the perception that we couldn't do anything. We can, right? And we are. There's a lot of moving parts. So, you know, for example, there's nothing in the Boise decision that says that you can live in a particular place. The Boise decision simply said, boiled down to its, you know, bare minimum, was that you can't have an ordinance against public or camping on public property. It didn't say you couldn't enforce littering, all the other things that are going on up there, the, you know, defecation in public and the destruction of property and all the other things that are going on up there. So to take enforcement action, when we started moving forward, we ran into some stuff, right? We ran into some speed bumps. Not the least of which was tow companies legitimately having concerns about managing these vehicles and primarily the trash that goes with these vehicles. And is a tow company willing to take the risk that they impounded a car that they're going to end up being dragged into a lawsuit because it was someone's home? You know, that's kind of on us to manage that and make sure that doesn't become a thing. But the legitimate concern is there for a business, right? There isn't a ton of money in any of the vehicles that we would be towing from there to begin with. Then you add the cost of the mitigation of trash. So we're working through all those things and arrangements with tow companies to the point where I'm willing to pay for dumpsters to sit at the tow yards for a period of time necessary to help mitigate trash. And we're working in that direction. We also have a long-term plan of trying to mitigate another camp popping up in another obvious area. I'm being intentionally vague here, so that we don't just play whack-a-mole and move a camp from this side of the island to another part of the island and that sort of thing. And at the same time, still continue to offer services and treatment for those people that are may at some point be interested in it. It's gotten to the point, though, where I go up and I talk to people up there and they say, well, I keep my yard clean. You don't have a yard on the side of a public road, right? And we have conversations like, well, you got to get rid of all those pallets. No, that's what I'm going to use to build my deck. And there's this mentality of, I live here, this is my yard. That's not the case.
Wow.
You know, so all of that aside, there is movement. There is plans going forward. We've been keeping track of the number of vehicles up there. There has been a reduction. Part of it is that we've towed as many as we can tow up until this point. There'll be more. And that word is getting out that we're not playing anymore.
Okay.
We're sending a very harsh message of, look, we get it. You're in a spot, but you got to participate in the program or you can't be here. Right. And that program is, when we offer you services, take advantage of services. My guess is, and I don't mean to be cynical, those people are not going to change their lifestyle. They haven't changed it in the 30 years that I've been interacting with most of them. But at some point or another, a community has the right to take care of a community, and 20 people that live on Hoffman Road don't have the right to steer the ship.
So some of the people that are residing there are declining services. I've heard this from Public Health and Human Services. Probably the majority are. What I hear you saying is that we're going to continue to extend services to places like Hoffman Road. And we're going to say that if you engage in services, you are not the folks that we are trying to be more strict about. And instead, but if you decline to take any services and you continue to engage in suspect behavior or irresponsible behavior in terms of public health, where you are working to figure out a way to, and you've already towed some vehicles, tow some of those vehicles away. You've been working with public health on dumpsters and places we can get rid of this trash. And then as you clear them out, you've told me, and I think it's okay for you to say for the record, how are you keeping those, as you tow them, how are you keeping folks from coming back and just filling in the hole?
So again, we're trying to put up physical barriers in obvious spots, you know, those places where a camp might.
Eco blocks or something like that.
Blocks, dirt berms, whatever ends up being the physical barrier that's the choice. For me, this is a little deeper than we're not attacking homeless people.
No.
We're attacking criminal and antisocial behavior in our community, right? The we've had two fires up there in the last 24 hours.
Oh my gosh. Had gunfire there a week or two ago.
We've had sporadic reports of gunfire, but of course nobody knows anything when the police get there. It's not a tenable situation. And as I'm done, I'm not playing anymore. We're going to do a cleanup up to the best of our ability up there. And we'll see what happens next.
So if this were a neighborhood and suddenly you had heightened criminal behavior, confirmed drug dealing, public health hazards, would we not act?
It is a neighborhood.
It is a neighborhood, and we are acting.
So I think right? That's the thing, is it's not fair to hold them to a different standard than we hold the rest of our community to. We expect law-abiding behavior. We expect people to engage in services when offered.
I mean, from a policy perspective, too, we're here to talk about policy ideas, right? So we like language that might limit the number of vehicles that can be in an area. We like language that says that you can't be here for beyond a certain period of time. But to your point, we actually give, not we, I don't know who the we is, the big collective government, we, these individuals actually have more rights than private property owners. We have code that says you cannot live in an RV on your own property.
That's right.
I think we should eliminate that code. At a minimum, a private property owner should be able to determine if this is a relative, a person that they're mentoring or caring about, they should be able to say, I'm willing to house that person on my property that I own. And we don't allow private property owners to have the same rights and privileges as these individuals have. So right off the bat, that's a code change I think we should make. Now, there will be people who say, I don't want my neighbor to make that choice. I understand that. I respect that. And I appreciate that. And respectfully, what I would say is when your neighbor's property comes for sale, you should own it so that you can control their choices. Until then, they control their choices on their property, but we're restricting private property owners more than we're, and that's part of the problem. There are people out there who have family members in the community. Why can't they live in an RV on that family member's property?
I support that opening, allowing people to have RVs on their own property that people are living in if they have the necessary permitted water and septic.
For sure. We can't waive the health requirements. But, or they have to drive them someplace and pump. But I agree. But that's something that we're doing that is exasperating this problem, right? We're not allowing that solution to come forward.
So I think a lot about the idea of a temporary permit, and I don't know if it's the magic bullet, but if my son became unemployed and lost his home and needed to move home, I get we give temporary permit. This always bothered me. We give temporary permits for people to live in RVs to build a nice house, but we don't give temporary permits for people to live in RVs to house a family member or a friend temporarily. And I get these are the rules, and some of us are rule followers. but there's, for me, it's always what's the human element. And I think the for me, this crossed the line with the amount of outreach we've done, the amount of, I mean, honestly, thank you to the two teams that are sitting in the room here, the amount of effort that's gone into trying to engage folks. And if they want to engage, we are happy to engage. If they refuse to engage and they just want to continue what is illegal behavior in any other part of our county, then I think it's time for us to address the illegal behavior.
What? Oh, sorry.
I think we, the RV issue, we have that on our comp plan. It's on the docket.
It's
the
within, the, but I,
if
I,
you wanted to address it earlier, Commissioner, I'd support
no,
it.
I mean, I'm going to get it in the comp plan. I think that's the appropriate way. I think, again, oh, sorry, I interrupted because I'm an aggressive
talker. Go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I think from a policy standpoint, again, what is not illegal in these conversations is being poor, right? Being poor. And so I had this conversation recently with the city of Oak Harbor, and it was a good conversation. The person I was talking, somebody from the city of Oak Harbor, I should not say the city, somebody from the city of Oak Harbor. It was a good conversation, but it was hung up in planning idealism, right? So I was like, look, we got to figure out how to preserve these mobile home parks. We got to figure out how to, can we push that APZ limit? Because you've already got sewer water infrastructure in an area. It will be easier to hook these folks up and get affordable housing built. Can we put more RV parks out there? Can we put more mobile home parks out there? What options do we have? The feedback I got was, and again, from a humanitarian standpoint and a health standpoint, I share it. It was, well, that's in the noise zone. Why are we putting people of lower income in the noise zone? I get it. But our policies are so protective of quality of life that I literally was like, so the option is they live on Hoffman Road or they live in a trailer park. And we are saying we don't want to sanction this kind of poverty living. So what we're doing is saying, we're going to make you homeless. And then we're going to call in the sheriff. And I'm going to use the tone that I use when I get mad. I know it's hard to differentiate from normal times. But so I use the tone because I'm like, this is a problem we need to solve. It is also a problem we've created. We, government, created this problem.
So, Commissioner, would you be in support of the county providing some part of county land where we have outlined, you know, you could put your RV here, you can put your car there. We will put dumpsters there. We will put all of those things there. We will come and keep it relatively clean.
I mean, I think that
people could move there.
I think we should treat it like affordable housing. I think we should have RV lots. You should qualify. You should meet certain standards. You pay what you can based on your income to be there. Yes, I think we should have those locations throughout the county, because what I am mostly upset about, one, the enforcement, we got to just keep putting the pressure on, which it sounds like you're doing. But the part we're not fundamentally owning is that we as government, not just local government, have pushed people into these situations because we say, if you don't meet this standard, you fall below it and you fall off the grid. People used to live in tenement housing. I don't know. People used to live in substandard housing. Mm-hmm. My best friend is married to a kid, a guy. He's a man. We're in our 50s. Married to a man who grew up in South Texas with a dirt floor. He didn't have a floor when he grew up. I'm not saying that that's ideal, but he had a home and he had a family. And he fought his way up, right? Their house now is beautiful. But we don't allow that. We don't let you be poor. And we need to go through our codes and figure out what are we doing to people that forces them off the grid, right? The addiction, that is a different conversation, right? The mental health, different conversation. But people who are just poor, who are falling through the cracks, we only say you can enter into this quality of housing and we will subsidize you to do it. And until we can subsidize you to do it, you're going to live on Hoffman Road. We got to figure out policy solutions between Hoffman Road and subsidized housing. That's our job right now, I think. So let them live on someone else's property. If you want to house somebody on your property, more power to you.
I don't think there's a one size fits all solution, right? So I've been paying very close attention to unhoused homeless people for the last several years. And I'm aware that there's a culture of people who are legitimately in a bad financial spot, probably for no fault of their own. You know, if you go into the parking lots of some of our businesses at 2 o'clock in the morning, especially in the city of Oak Harbor, you see people sleeping in their car. I am aware of several people who work full time, sleep in their car, and maybe can afford a gym membership, and they use the gym membership so that they can have a hot shower and a bathroom to use every day before they go to work. And then there's a culture who just chooses to live that way, and whether they, you know, if it's a chicken or egg situation, whether they would have lived that way prior to their drug involvement, or that their drug involvement has created this mentality of this is the way I want to live. It's still a thing, right? But there's two separate problems here.
But you got to tease them out.
Right. And somehow there needs to be a way to sort those lines and help the people that are interested in a hand up versus placating people that are interested in a handout, in my opinion.
So, commissioners, what would you think if we asked Connie's group to bring back identified properties?
So identified properties for what?
For RV parks.
I want to get I just want to be clear because I heard on the news that you can't use county parks for that because you end up with an inability to control what happens. And so I just want some guidance on that was one of the ideas I was thinking about. Do we have a place where we can divert? We've talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
But after listening to the news, I'm just nervous that what I don't want to do is give up control.
We got to detox you from the news.
We'll detox all of us from
that. Can you clarify that? What? Why would we lose control of saying what people can do on county-owned property?
Basically, that you can't.
We already did.
I just need to know what was said. And it's just this one thing. And it raised a red flag for me because what it basically was saying is if we say everyone can move and here's a safe place and we give the sheriff the tools to say take your RV and you can go here, that and it was confusing to me because the state parks will often take RVs for temporary times, and you know the county parks could do that, but there was something where they weren't able to then ask people to leave because of the Homestead Act, because it was on county property. And so they weren't able to ask people to leave. So what happens if we have escalating issues or the same sorts of things? Are we giving up control? So then they were looking at private property options to do that. And it just, I did not have time to research this, but that's my worry is because of the Homestead Act, do we give up? Because I actually like the idea as one option. I'm looking for tools in the toolbox that we could look at.
We don't have to be the underlying owner.
That's right. And I,
but right now we need to go, we'll have to use the comp plan process because where we're at, we don't have the ability to place these RV parks anywhere under our current zoning. So we're going to need to build in code, or we need to build in policy language that says that this is one of the things we're trying to support in our community. Then we would have to write follow-on code that would say, these are some areas we'd have to designate some zones for this to happen. I mean, it's not really a Connie thing. It's a land use issue. Right now, our density limitation would limit the creation of these. But we can figure out a way around that, right? That just takes work if we want to do it.
I just want the research done.
Connie's policy conversations are, can we draft code language that limits the number of RVs somewhere? And again, we'll need legal for this. Can we draft code language that says that you're limited for a certain period of time? Are there types of roads that we want to say there's no overnight parking on, period? I think that is an appropriate conversation to have because some roads aren't safe. In fairness to the individuals who are on Hoffman Road, it is not a bad location, right? It is not. It is next to gravel pits. It is not a well-traveled road. I mean, I'm traveling it now to keep my eye on the situation, but I lived my entire life here and had never been on that road before. I've never needed it, right? That's not a road I would need to travel unless you're bypassing an accident. It's not a poor choice. It's just been too long and too intense. And so I think when we're picking roads, I mean, there are some that are just like, this is not safe. There's not a wide enough shoulder. It's near critical or sensitive areas. I mean, Spokane has signs up that say you can't overnight camp within a certain distance of a railroad track, right? So there are things that you can do to say this is not appropriate. Zoning all the time says this behavior can't be near a school.
That's common zoning language, right? So are there things that we can say, we do not allow overnight camping within 1,000 feet of a school? I don't know that we have any we have some in counties. Those are the types of tools we have to start looking for to say we need to negate this impact and manage it in the most responsible way. The other thing on this RV park concept is it's managed. You're vetted in through coordinated entry, pay what you can pay. It's managed in the same way. What I'm not personally in favor of is we're going to fence an area and let it be a free-for-all in that area. And we say, you can go there. I'm not in favor of that because to me, that's basically the county saying, we're not going to make you follow any codes. And then if we do that, I'm like, well, then let's lift them on everyone and let it be a free-for-all.
And if it goes through coordinated entry to go in there, you sign an agreement and then we have something. Right. Because I think that is one of the tools we can use in the toolbox. The other one I want to look at, which we've talked some, is what are some no parking solutions that we should consider? And I'd like to see 3 or 4 proposals countywide, just on arterials.
I think the commissioner just suggested some as well.
Okay.
Around school zones or near critical areas or what have you. Yeah, we can bring some.
Maybe
forward.
We say no in accident potential zones. That would eliminate the Hoffman problem, right?
Is that an APC zone?
Yeah, it is. I mean, of course it is. All of North Whidbey, it seems to be.
All of Island County.
as it suits us. It's our best tool and our worst enemy.
I would just offer that. Make the intent clear. So there was a recent court case essentially challenging the Boise decision, and it was a city in Oregon, and I'm missing the name of the city that ended up in this federal court case. I don't think it was LeGrand, but Grants Pass. Thank you.
Oh, I read about that one.
So and Grants Pass essentially said, well, we're going to make an ordinance that says you can't do X.
That's right.
And the court ruled that, well, you've attempted to pass an ordinance to circumvent our decision.
Right.
So obviously we'd want to be smart about that, right? So.
Are there any other kinds of codes, though, that we haven't talked about that you think we should be looking at, Sheriff?
With the clarity that I've gotten from our civil attorneys about the particular problem, and it doesn't matter if it's Hoffman Road or any other camp on public property, I don't necessarily think adding additional laws are going to solve the problem, right? We had a perceived lack of enforceability for a long time until we had put some real thought from legal brains into the court decision out of Boise. It's still illegal to litter. It's still illegal to abandon your vehicle on the roadway. It's still illegal to do public defecation and urination and all the other things that are happening. We just have to figure out a way to manage the enforcement of that and make sure that we're doing it in a way that doesn't get Island County sued in federal court for violating anybody's constitutional rights. So, and then in addition to that, we have to manage all the resources. You know, we've had a very comprehensive conversation with the entire county that's been involved in this where, I talked about we had to work with the tow companies to figure out a solution to that particular problem. And Connie's team has been up to their neck in paving this time of year. So there's no equipment or people available to do some of the things that we've been trying to do. So it is moving forward. It's just managing all of those little cogs in the wheel to make it move forward. So to answer your question, very long-winded, I don't know. I can't think anything off the top of my head that if we only had a law, we could make this problem go away or would help us mitigate it. I think we have plenty of laws.
No magic wand.
We just have to, make good decisions in enforcing the existing laws.
But you did bring up a good point that I think could use some internal interdepartmental coordination, which is from a budgetary standpoint, do we need to start allocating funds towards mitigating these problems? So the cost of towing, right? I made a note on there, like, should we put a tow company under contract where they're getting paid a fee every month guaranteed to respond to our phone calls, right? That can we do something like that? What can we do to incentivize that industry to be more responsive to our needs? How much will that cost? How much money should we have set aside for cleanup and dumpsters? And I mean, there is a budgetary component to this. If the community says, look, we want to set a higher standard, okay, but we're going to have to pay for that.
I think that's actually probably more of a likely need than additional county codes, right? Keep in mind the county codes are generally civil or misdemeanors, right? There's lots of misdemeanors and civil infractions going on Hoffman Road. So but there is going to be a cost, and it's either going to come out of Connie's budget or my budget or a combination of both.
Well, we like Connie's budget better.
I do too.
Sorry, Connie. No offense, those Connie. Road funds are much more fun to spend.
But the reality is, I mean, what was the number? We were 20,000 or more, I think.
20,000 just for public works during the one big cleanup.
One day, right. We'll have another 20,000 or more dollar day at some point. But in the meantime, we're going to be paying for garbage disposal. And we talked about things like, okay, so do we just add an additional $100 fee per tow onto the vehicle so the tow companies can mitigate trash? And we talked about, and where we settled was, and we're pretty fortunate that especially the North Whidbey tow companies they're not making any money on this deal, right? If anything, they're probably going to break even on most of the vehicles that we end up in, you know, towing or signing off as Hulk vehicles, but they're willing to do it because they're invested in this community and they want to help clean up the problem. And I sincerely appreciate that. We had a really long talk about what the drawbacks are from the you know, they're in business to make a living, right? They're not in business to do charitable work. So, but they're also being very extremely reasonable when it comes to helping us find a solution, as have the neighbors, the gravel companies, super patient, super helpful. But we're kind of up against some timelines here, right? There's projects that need to move forward for the gravel pit, for example, you know.
You know, that actually brings up a question. Sorry, was I interrupting you? I'm an interrupter. But that actually brings up a question maybe I would have for you, Connie. So let's say we have an identified road project on Hoffman. We're going to go in there. We're going to chip seal it's the county. We're going to chip seal and we need to do some stuff. And there are people living there and we have a project coming up. How do we get them to move? I mean, we must have a mechanism because in that situation, we wouldn't pave around them.
That's a good question.
We have had vehicles in the right of way that we need moved, not necessarily being inhabited. Made up a word there. and we usually tag it. We'll reach out to the homeowners if there's someone nearby to see if it's theirs. We'll put notices. We'll do as much as we can. And we involve the sheriff's office in making sure that we can get it cleared before our work is underway.
We do have a project that's going to start in 2024, and it's the repaving of the field, Adult Field, that's going to go, and all that construction is going straight through that gate right there.
But what I'm trying to even thinking through, what are we dealing with, right? If somebody was living in their car and we had to pave that road, but we can get them to move. We don't not pave the road and we don't pave around them. So those same tools should work in this situation. One, because we do have a project coming up, mm-hmm. but two, we have the ability to do this when we have special projects. We have it.
Right. So if it's a car and they don't move it, we can tow it.
Right.
If there's somebody living in it, it's more difficult to move while they're in there.
Still,
so we haven't run into that
legally.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what I think that's what you're saying is maybe we don't need more code. I think the other part is we have to stay on top of it. Are we wanting me to shut up?
No, you're fine. Okay. We've got
sometimes
plenty of time.
Sometimes those side conversations are really like, when is she going to stop talking? And so I want to be.
This one wasn't.
That wasn't? Okay.
He'll let you know.
So, I mean, maybe also one of our things is that we need to identify when we get to two vehicles and then we start acting, right? That we don't let it get to a certain number. There's a certain number where we're like, we have to start enforcement now before it exasperates. Because this situation got away from us. I mean, in fairness, someone told me about it, honest to God, a year and a half or 2 years ago. And I kind of eye rolled. I'm not going to lie. I really was like, okay, the sheriff will get to it. We have encampments everywhere. We're fine. Right. And did not understand the significance of what was continuing to happen. we let it go too far.
So what is our number? Is it 2? Is it 5? Is it 10? What is our number?
Well, I wonder if the solution isn't maybe a combination of those things, like moving forward, right? I don't think that people necessarily have, I think it would be, I mean, how do I phrase this? I think it'd be more acceptable if this were a simple, hey, I'm camping overnight here, mm-hmm. right? It's different when you dump 300 yards, cubic yards of waste in the roadway and you behave the way you're behaving.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a camping ordinance and we're talking about a campground, but there's also an accountability perspective here that is a problem, right? And we're kind of, as a culture, not just this room, but as a culture, we're kind of painting that all with the same brush.
It's because we can regulate land use and camping and roads. And the thing that we are unable to do is to regulate someone's choices, right? One, we don't want to do that. I don't think personally, I don't want government regulating my choices. But second, that's the uncontrollable piece of all of this. And so we're trying to control the pieces that are within our purview. I mean, definitely there are rules about littering and, you know, there are rules out there and we can enforce upon those rules. That is a major commitment that I think we probably need to make in this location. I mean, don't litter. Are we going to start putting people in jail for littering? I don't know. That's not my call. Well, and our jail's not big enough.
I think, and it's expensive. That can end up being as expensive as cleaning it up, right? So,
well, and it can end up being a circular thing.
And I don't even know if it's a civil violation or a criminal.
And my other challenge is, you know, because we've talked about these things, all of us individually with Rick or Connie, is, you know, citing these vehicles. And then what? Like, they're not going to pay the citation, you know? And
90% of the time, they don't own the vehicle, right? So
right.
If we drive up to a vacant car parked on the side of the roadway and we decide to give it a parking ticket or an illegal dumping ticket, we send it to the last registered owner, which can be pretty ambiguous, right? A lot of these vehicles aren't even the same vehicle they were when the VIN number was applied, right? There's a lot of behavior here that doesn't fit into what law-abiding citizens view as, well, duh, why don't you do X, right? It's a little more complicated.
And that's why I appreciate when we've drilled down on these conversations that we're not trying to make empty gestures like we're going to criminalize these vehicles, and because that doesn't solve the problem, right? So what I'm looking for are things like the complexity of you being able to get the dumpsters, get the tow companies, put in the eco blocks, clean it up. But what we also know, and the whack-a-mole conversation, is this one grew coincidentally or caused by our cleanup of Jones Road.
Well, at the same time, we had Jones Road, we had Stellar Lane, we had several other where we closed down the park and ride at Hoffman, and that sort of started the ball rolling. But in the same time period, we cleaned up several private properties that had this stuff going on, and. Honestly, I think it's...
And we're not going to stop doing that.
We're posting on social media, not we, but people in the community are posting on social media that, hey, there's a great place for homeless people in Island County on Hoffman Road. Mm. So we've got residents from outside the county moving in there.
Well, let's move
it. We need to send a different message.
Yeah.
We need to send a message that's not a great place to live. It's not a great place to you know, have that lifestyle. And we're not going to tolerate it anymore.
All right. Well, it sounds like some of the ideas we want to pursue are limiting number. I think that's something that we need to we need to get some internal understanding of when we start putting pressure, when we hit 3, when we hit 5, like there's a threshold number that goes from people who need to live on the side of the road to an encampment. I think the culture of everybody living together is part of the problem, right? I they're feeding off each other in terms of behaviors. We got to break them up. Then limited length of time. If we can figure out, we only allow this for a certain period of time and then you have to move on. We're not saying you can't do it in Island County. We're saying you got to move to a different area. I think that might be legally defensible. I'll wait for the legal feedback that tells me that the board's trying to break laws. And again, we're not trying to violate constitutional rights. We're trying to respect the rights of neighborhoods. a neighborhood can't sustain this for this amount of time. It adversely affects their quality of life too. And that we have a responsibility to protect, as well as the constitutional rights of these individuals. We like that. We like looking at the comp plan process to allow designated areas for RV parks. We like the idea that maybe we'll look at our code to say that we'll allow RVs on private property, probably limit it to one, maybe two. I mean, I don't like to limit private property rights, but, you know, I don't want people going nuts. I mean, those were some ideas that we came up with. We talked about maybe putting a tow company under contract so that they're guaranteed a flat amount of money in addition to what they would get paid to do the work, so that we're recognizing the risk that they're taking on, acknowledging the financial burden. I mean, we can't afford to have these tow companies go out of business, right? We can maybe look at something like that that's legal.
I think we also talk about maybe having a budget
good budget
piece that really we need to have a budget item that's about managing homelessness.
Can we talk, as you know, it struck yesterday when Sean presented his DOE contract and we had 14,000 in solid waste for homeless encampments. That's a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk legislatively about going to this? The state's having this conversation across our state. We're not unique. Can we look at sources of funding and ask for something that's reasonable for funding to address this problem? So I think in these solid waste contracts that we get from Commerce or DOE, or I don't know if we get them from Commerce, I think they're DOE, that we say, hey, legislature, you guys need to help us address this problem and ask for funding that's appropriate to the size of the problem we're trying to solve.
Commissioners, can I make a suggestion? I think you've come up with some interesting and creative and potentially successful options, but I think
make it brilliant, but okay.
Let's not get crazy. and I think you're missing an opportunity, which is that you have dozens, if not maybe 100 people who are highly skilled and qualified in their specific expertise areas that work for you, that you have not really asked for their solutions. And so I would.
That's not true.
They're not here. They haven't provided a list. They're not part of the conversation at the table. And so what I would suggest is that you direct the directors of Public Works and Human Services and Public Health and Planning and others that might be involved, but those are the four that I think are most likely to get together and as a team create a list of solutions that are coming forward and in a little bit more of a cohesive way. I think all the things that you talked about should be put into that conversation, but you don't need to solve the problem.
Well, we have our team.
Have to come up with solutions independently. You can act on those resources.
We have our team meetings coming up where we are now regularly scheduled to meet with departments as a business meeting, as a team. This is an appropriate content to bring to those business meetings, is we've got the different groups coming together to meet with the board per the request of the board to have business meetings. I don't remember what we're calling them.
Business meetings.
Okay. Then this is an area of content where we can bring back the ideas and solutions. And not lose sight of that collaborative approach.
Something I keep thinking about throughout this whole thing that I'm just really curious about is how often is Island County going to these homeless encampments and making sure that the honey wagons are, you know, cleaned out, that the dumpsters are being done. I mean, I think if we are allowing this, because in our conversation it's clear we are to some degree allowing it, there's also a responsibility as part of that.
Do we have a regular
schedule of keeping, you know, as hygienic as we can manage?
Sean's nodding yes. Sean, you got to talk in the mic if you're going to talk. Oh, Connie's going.
Wait, you can tap out.
Didn't get out fast enough. Yeah, so we do. Our solid waste staff are visiting regularly and, you know, maintaining. We have folks as part of the contract with the dumpsters Heather's on the line as well if you'd like more detailed update. Yeah. But yeah.
Now I'm going back to what you said, because I don't disagree that we need creative solutions to come forward. One thing I maybe would want to share, since we have so many leaders here, is we've had public comment on this for 6 to 9 months, right? I've sent at least 2 emails saying, what are we doing? The board and the public are saying we got a problem here. And I guess I'm unclear as to why it takes a directive to say, bring ideas to me. People aren't coming into my office with ideas or solutions. Nobody has come in and said, hey, what about the no RVs on private property thing? Nobody's coming in saying, hey, we want to limit the time people can park on the side of the road. This might be an idea. I mean, in fairness to what you said, because I think you're right that we need to get ideas to come to us. At the same time, they don't. They don't come to us. And so what happens is we start to fill the void with our brilliance, right? I hear from the community, I have a solution. Now, maybe that's cultural and we're supposed to stop doing that. But this isn't new news. This meeting is the result of extreme frustration of how do we get from A to B? And by the way, we're the only people pushing the alphabet. Yeah. And so in fairness to the board, why does it take this? Why? I think that's something for department heads to talk about. Why do you make the board start generating ideas and then only react to those ideas to solve community-based problems that we know are significant? I sent a high importance email. Do you know how many high importance email I've sent in 11 years? I'm guessing maybe 6. Probably less. And who's come into my office to say, you could try this, we could try this, what about this? Should we bring this policy conversation forward? And I'm not trying to call people out. I know this is what nobody likes about me, is the public flogging, but also there needs to be some recognition of like, look, she sent a high importance email.
I remember seeing the email and
it was
absolutely recognize that you have been asking for that and the board's been asking for that. And it's been something that's been talked about up there. My point was more to the extent that since that has not worked and people have not brought forward those things, is make it more clear from the board as a whole saying, this is something that we want done. It is a task to do. Please go do it.
Because we're coming up with ideas.
And honestly, some of them are really good, but since what has happened so far hasn't worked, my suggestion is do something more and be more direct.
So follow up in the minutes is that we're going to bring the ideas presented today as well as additional ideas forward at one of our team meetings.
And do we have additional ideas?
Well, we don't know yet.
Well, we've got, I guess I would be surprised if our departments haven't put thought towards ideas by now. Right? How do you have ideas? We've got 25 minutes.
A lot of the internal staff level conversations actually have reflected some of what's come forward today, at least from public health, but there's been collaborative conversations with planning and around, you know, the idea of a diversion place for folks to go. And so there are lots of internal conversations happening. And a lot of our focus was on the outreach response and coordination with the sheriff and the work that's being done out on Hoffman. But there are long range ideas and a lot of talk internally of how we align that with the comp planning.
And Heather has got her hand up as well, who's deeply been involved in this. So I'm going to let Heather speak for a second. Heather?
Sorry, I have a jet flying over, but I was just... I am working on a list of potential properties after a conversation that Commissioner Johnson and I had about coordinated entry, pay what you can, potential sites. So we are working on that from a critical aquifer recharge look and places that we can use that maybe the county already owns. So I do have a list I'm working on to bring to all of you in one-on-ones, just for heads up.
Okay.
Parking recreational vehicles for more than 48 hours in one place on a county road could be prohibited, and you have to move the vehicle at least a mile. And that would cause people to disperse. Then it comes down to a question, and I don't want to put you on the spot and answer it right now, Sheriff, but that becomes back, I think, with a list of other potential ordinances like that. Are they enforceable? Can they effectively work? I've seen that in the city, so that people didn't stay permanently in a location. They moved around, and in many cases they left the city. They came back, but they left and they came back. They left and they didn't make it their home.
We had a situation, and this is where Human Services was really helpful, where an RV broke down and then there was a car there that was just outside the city limits. So it was in county land, and they helped get the necessary funding. It was during COVID funding, but they used some of that to get the necessary funding to do the repair to the RV so they could move on and out. And so that's also, you know, one of the things that we can do. We don't have that level of funding support anymore. We don't have that same level.
We have lots of homeless housing dollars in this county.
And
are we flexing those dollars to their max?
And we also had a situation where they did the same thing, pulling where one of your deputies had an abandoned car, a woman living with her child in the car. They were able to tow the car. Then we were able to get repairs to the car. And I think those are some of the other solutions we can have where there's a legitimate reason and a way to help. But yeah, that's a question for, is that how we would use our document recording fees, for example? So that's a good conversation that we could have. Is it a different way to think about, but it helps those folks who are struggling and forced to live in their cars move into a different situation and find a way to move on.
One of the ideas that did come from Human Services that I like that we have not followed up on extensively is, why can't every church house two RVs in their parking lots, right? I don't know. I go to church. It's about like love and kindness and compassion and caring. You don't have two parking spots to care for two people in our community, an entire congregation taking care of two people or two families is manageable, right?
That's an Island County code, because we had a thing called POP. I can't remember what it stands for, but we were basically helping with transitioning a prisoner who they got him an RV, and we would have put him on our property at church to house him. And we were told we could not by code.
Well,
and we were sponsoring this entire individual. That's a great example.
First of all, churches can pretty much do what they want in alignment with their religious.
Well, they were told they could not. So, yeah.
Well, again, now here I'm getting the tone, because our code says you can't responsibly solve a problem. You can just simply go out there and create chaos. And that's where I'm angry at government and us, right? Why? Why can't two RVs be on a property? Why can't we say, look, you can't sustain 28 that aren't on a septic, but you can manage two RVs? Because there are a lot of churches in this community. And if every church took two, we don't have people living on Hoffman Road. And that is a conversation of, let's pull these church leaders together and say, look, this is what we see. And by the way, if our code's in the way, we fix it.
Blessed are the poor.
I mean, and I understand that this happens in cities too. And so we'll need to talk to cities. But in reality, we've got to allow those who are willing to serve to serve. We don't even let people be good-hearted or solve problems. We just say, we want to stigmatize you and put you on the side of the road and then give you rights. Wow, that's good. That's where I'm upset at government, right? That's what we're doing wrong.
Well, that's lots of stuff. We feel like we've covered this, and it's, do you want to have more? Do we want to move on to the next agenda item? Where are you two at?
I'm at the anger level.
Are we angry?
Connie's up. Connie is tapping out Sean.
Tap out Sean. Rick's going, what?
He's the only one that can get you out.
So definitely outside of my wheelhouse, but and I'm sure you guys have probably heard about it. And I think that's part of what I kind of hold back, but they probably heard about this one, was just where some agencies have taken over parking lots and put in like just the Home Depot storage sheds for overnight housing, where it can be controlled environment. People can come in for that night. And then it's in the example I had heard, it was an overnight type of thing. And then they go back out the next day, but they all have a place to stay overnight. They don't have to have an RV, which is maybe an issue that
my argument where with communities who want us to move homeless encampments along, but will not allow us to promote things like overnight shelters and transitional housing. And so I've been fairly clear that it goes both ways, that we have to support housing solutions all along the housing spectrum, from overnight shelters to temporary transitional housing to permanent supportive housing to tiny housing where it's appropriate based on septic and water. And when the community wants to come and yell at us for several months about the same thing over and over again,
legitimately yell at it.
Well, I would say sometimes it wasn't so legitimate. When they say, we want those people to be in Oak Harbor where they belong, you were not happy with that.
Well, that's because out of 87,000 residents, the general consensus is Oak Harbor can bear the burden of that problem.
Right.
As if those kids aren't getting high on South Whidbey, as if we don't have any mental health.
Push that button.
Well, it is. It's not my button, actually.
And it's fair. It's
a community
this
button.
This is a shared
we are
problem.
Policy stops.
This is a shared problem that all of our communities need to be involved in the solutions. And I would be loath and inauthentic to not say that I will continue to support housing solutions that help us give resources to the sheriff and our outreach workers when they're trying to find solutions for the people who are struggling. And tiny houses or those sorts of things have been proven to be part of that solution. I believe down on South Whidbey, their tiny houses, Coyle Shepherd's group got a grant for this.
Which she was able to do because the city of Langley has different codes than the county. You couldn't do a tiny house village.
Which because they have sewer.
Unincorporated.
Which because they have sewer.
I think that idea is good. I also think that, I mean, partly where I'm sensitive to making sure that we have RV options is in knowing people who are off the grid a little bit. Their stuff matters to them in a weird way. I mean, those pallets that we're like, throw those away, right? That stuff that we think is trash is all they have. And so the idea that you just go someplace, sleep, pack it up, put it on your back and move around. I mean, part of upward mobility is the accumulation of stuff. And so I think that's part of what this is that I know now I switched to hippie. I got done yelling and now I went back to hippie.
Is that what you do?
I know you do. But part of it is, it's like, okay, we need to accommodate human needs as well, right? And so how do we do that so people feel like they have their space, their things, their pots and pans? And it's not just like, well, I had a place to sleep and now I'm out in the elements for the rest of the day.
I hear you saying
more of a home environment.
I hear you also saying spectrum. That you're not in support of those sweeps where we take everybody's belongings.
Oh, I don't like that.
Yeah. So anything else? Is that Tony's
here? Can you get this done by next week?
I did take a note that the sheriff is adamant we're going to do a cleanup of Hoffman Road. So when can we expect to know that that's been done, Sheriff?
I don't want to put a timeline on it, and not because I'm not courageous enough to put a timeline on it. I just don't know when all the moving pieces are going to fall together. So I know that Connie's team is working on some barriers. And when they went out there yesterday where there wasn't a trailer, there now is a trailer. So we're having to mitigate that trailer and the work is continuing, but it's going to, ultimately I had a goal of having this substantially cleaned up by the end of October. I hope we can get there by the end of October, but I don't want to promise the community that there's going to be some miracle that occurs. And because at the end of the day, we can impound all the unauthorized vehicles and we can do all those things, but we still have that same 20 or 30 people that are going to live somewhere.
Right.
But I can't in good conscience continue to allow for them to destroy that entire roadway. And I got to find the right balance of compassion and accountability. And I will always say that, right? I don't think it's super compassionate to let people live in their own filth. And I know it's not compassionate to the tax paying neighbors around there that are going, why do I have to tolerate this? I play by the rules. So,
the Public Works is geared up to fully support this in the month of October.
Okay. Who can, maybe this is something I don't totally understand. So I've heard anecdotal stories about some of the people out there. Who's out there actually? Are they local residents? Are they, I mean, who, because we're visiting them. Who, I don't need names. Who are these individuals?
I think there's a mix. I would say the majority is people I would call local. There's a couple of folks that come and go from Skagit County, for example. There's some people that show up for 3 days and then we never see them again. But there is a core group up there, and this is going to be harsh, but they have never played by the rules, and they are never going to play by the rules, regardless of how much free stuff government gives them. They're going to still live their lifestyle because that's what they've chosen to do.
Are they criminals?
Probably, in a lot of cases.
We need a bigger jail. I mean, I'm not for putting people with mental health issue in jail if that's their only issue. But if what we're talking about is willful disregard for laws, intentional disregard for laws, people who break the law intentionally go to jail. I mean, even if you love them, they go to jail. In fact, people go to jail for breaking the law unintentionally. So I mean, part of what I'm trying to solve is and I think we're all trying to solve, is a humanitarian problem, right? Is this a poverty issue? How do we care for people who are ill, who have, like, maybe they're on disability, they can't afford to live in this housing market, they're figuring out solutions, this is what they've got. Okay, that's the problem I'm trying to solve. But if they're just out there because they steal things, they do drugs, they deal drugs, they prostitute themselves, all the things that we've heard that are going on, that I just described criminal behavior. And the solution to that problem is you don't live free. You don't live free. You traded that right. I'm not trying to find solutions for criminal behaviors. I am encouraging us to lock up criminals.
And when it's the appropriate thing to do, that's what we do.
Okay. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out who's there, right? And also, if these are local community members, that's our responsibility, right? We take care of our community members.
You get into a conversation about when do they become community members, right? When they move their RV onto Hoppin Road from another county, or did they live here for three generations? I've had conversations with people in this community about, well, I've been here for three generations, so I have special island rights, and I don't know what those are. They're not anywhere.
Actually, I think I have those too.
All right.
Okay.
I want to thank you, Sheriff, for being here. Are we done?
What's our comeback plan?
We have, what I had is a lot of the conversation that's happened is going back to the department heads. They're going to come back to the business meeting as a whole and be all at the table to develop tools. The sheriff's continuing to work on his cleanup plan of specifically Hoffman Road and with Public Works, and so maybe come back and report in on that in a month, how that's going. But I think the bigger policy conversations are coming back first to the board meeting, and then we'll come back to a work session when we circle in on a few of them. That's what I heard today. Did you guys hear anything different?
The first of those business meetings is October 3rd. You might want to just say that's 2 weeks from yesterday, maybe getting a report.
I mean, I think maybe from October 3rd, one thing I would expect is the budget ask.
That's right.
Can we get the budget ask by October 3rd?
Yeah, I think the budget ask, and as we do as we prepare in October, we also have our Sean, this is to you. Someone asked.
I apologize for interrupting. Layla just corrected me. It's actually the 10th. The 3rd is, I had that date.
Okay, so October 10th. We also have our legislative policy conversation in October. If we wish to ask for funding to increase response, I'd like to have that come in a coordinated way from whichever, whoever's going to bring that. So we want to get money in our budget, both county dollars, but I'd like to access the state dollars. We want the policy changes, and then you'll check in, do a check-in with us on next steps.
Just to clarify what Commissioner on a point on Commissioner Bacon's statement. I fully intend to do everything we can to clean up that mess, but we're not going to stop offering outreach resources as well.
Right.
So it's not, we're not drawing a line in the sand saying we don't like you anymore. Sure. So,
but we don't like you there. I mean,
well, and we don't like your choices,
but you got to move to a new street. That neighborhood's done. Just to be clear on my level of harshness, you got to move.
And the reason we support diversion programs is we want them to make different choices. We don't like their choices.
Right.
We've had some I'll call it low hanging fruit successes. And you talked about some of them where we've been able to, you know, spend $150 to repair somebody's RV so they could move on. And there's been people that we have provided transportation to. You know, there's one young man that can't remember. I think he wanted to go to Missouri or Kansas where he had family support. We'll make that happen all day long, right? I mean, one-way trips to Kansas are a pretty good investment, right? So all of those tools are being applied. We just haven't had any quantity of success. And honestly, it's you take one off of this end and one comes on this end. So I think there's a message that needs to be sent that this is not utopia for people who choose to
You live said that this became a concerted, and I heard this from Chris Matushi before he left, that this became a concerted, hey guys, come here.
Well, that's what King County's for.
Hey guys, come here, and we've got this thing going on, and so we're going to nip that in the bud.
Hopefully. I mean, when I started trying to manage this, the original goal was that it was going to be a two-step process, right? We're going to go out, we're going to provide all the resources that we have available to us. And when it comes to housing, unfortunately, that's not a lot. We don't have, you know, 30 empty beds in Island County that we can put people in, or even in our reach in the region. And we sent a very clear message that day of this is not sustainable. We're not going to allow this continue. Now, it has taken significantly longer for us to move into phase two of a more aggressive cleanup, because we had all these conversations and distractions that were legitimate. You know, I mean, for example, I had to get over a belief by tow companies that if there was a sleeping bag in the car, they should not impound it because they're going to lose their business and lose their license for impounding somebody's home. And that came from an authority in the towing world, right? That was not good legal advice, and it created a legitimate anxiety and an understandable anxiety among tow company owners, for example. So all of those little things that have to, all those little kinks that have to be worked out have caused this to take a lot longer than we'd hoped, but I think we're still moving in the same direction.
I think that I'm going to make an assumption. I could be wrong. I'm going to make an assumption that there's a church consortium in Island County. Most communities have a group of church that they get together. I would encourage the church consortium to talk about what Commissioner Johnson was saying earlier about if every church took an RV or two, we wouldn't have a Hoffman Road problem. And consider what Commissioner St. Clair was saying, that the difficulty is the county code. I think that if any church went and said, okay, we'll allow two RVs to be parked in our parking lot and people to live there, I personally would discourage our planning department from doing any kind of code enforcement on that. And I would expect that we can amend
the code to allow for something like that so that it doesn't appear arbitrary.
That are in the county.
For those churches that are in the county.
Let's start where we can start, and then we'll have conversations with our municipal partners. I mean, it's probably public health code and not planning code. And public health is interjurisdictional. Public health has more power in a city than cities acknowledge. We just don't flex. So maybe if what is limiting is the public health code, what I would encourage is for public health to say, what do we have in place that limits this from happening? Maybe it's a state problem. But the reality is that we know that Seattle, we've seen it on the news, I watch it too. they fence in areas and put a bunch of people in there. They're suspending their public health code to do that somehow. So there's a way to do it. Linda has some documentation she sent me on the ideas on how to do it. Let's figure out how to do that, because that's our fastest solution, is to say, you don't have to change your lifestyle. We're just going to put no more than two of you in an area, and then keep eyes on it, on the people, right? Part of what they don't like is, part of what's great about Hoffman Road is we don't see it, but they're not seeing, right? If you get eyes on people, their behavior's different. I behave a lot better in public than I do in private, which I know shocks all of you on what I'd be like in private, but it's just true. Everybody's that way.
So we're talking about solutions to house. You mentioned that the majority of these folks are folks who are, many of them are residents. Some of them come from Skagit back and forth. That's not surprising. What I want to be clear, because some of the advice we've been given from the public is load them up and ship them out. And we don't do that. That's not who we are. And that's also not legal. And the false narrative that and it's funny, Rick, you remember when you and I had a conversation a couple of years ago, because your brother is a sheriff in upstate New York. And we talked about that everybody is shipped out of New York City up to upstate. It's the same narrative from every state.
Sure.
You know, that's not what's true. We are working to solve problems with folks that are generally our residents. And as Commissioner Johnson said, passionately, not angrily, but passionately, as we have a responsibility to care for everyone.
We do. You're on. I appreciate the balanced approach you're taking. I think we have some ideas to follow up on. We're going to get the budget request back.
All right. Thank you. We're going to let Tony come up, and I'm going to take a 2-minute break because of coffee.
Mine's gone already.
All right. Thank you. That was a good discussion. Tony, Mr. Tony Lamb is coming to give us our treasurer's report.
Tony, we need some money, as you just heard.
You always have money, just how much, though. Good morning, commissioners. My name again is Tony Lamb from the Treasurer's Office. I'm here to present the financial data as of August 31st. I'll be going through the interest rates. Shall I continue reading the interest rates, or do I just go ahead and briefly?
Just go through however you want to bring it forward.
Okay.
Go.
So interest rates, for the investment pool, we have 1.93%, and that's for the county's pool. For the Washington State LGIP, we have the rate of 5.34%. Treasurer's rates, U.S. Treasury's rates varies. The one that I want to point out is the U.S. Treasury 2-year, which is comparable to what we're trying to go to, is 4.88%.
Before the transition, when Wanda Grohn was still here,
yes,
she had gone to a presentation of the state treasurer where he was beginning to diversify the state assets. And I don't remember enough, but I'm concerned our rate has remained a little too low compared to the other rates. And I know some of it's a function of long-term holds and calls, but maybe at some point I'd like a conversation, whether it's at our finance meeting or it's here with the entire board, uh-huh, about what options are available to Island County to increase our rates within our existing financial policies, because it feels like we at one point during COVID we were all happy because we were higher when other rates were at 0.5%, right? Or 1%, right. And here we were, and we've had this inverse curve. And I'd like to have a better understanding of what are within our options, within our financial policies, to bring our rates up some. And I don't know if this is the place. I just want to have that conversation.
Okay.
Mr. Johnson?
I think a little bit the finance committee needs to have it. I am concerned. Uh-huh. That Island County investment pool is so much lower.
Right.
And that our junior taxing districts are in there. Right. Yes, so yes, we're benefiting from diversification. Those junior taxing districts, some of them are all in on our pool and they're making 3 percentage points right, less. We right, need to figure out how to, we need to, or we need to offset them, and we're going to take the lower hit, and we're going to push them out and buy them out and put let them go into larger pools or large other funds where they can make more interest. But I'm a little bit concerned about the fact that, you know, we've got one thing at 5.34 and we're at 1.93.
Right. The LGIP, their investments are really short term, within the, I believe it's a 6 year. So when the interest rate drops, they would drop drastically.
Sure.
And so our pool is more extended out and we purchase for a longer period of time. And that's why our interest rate is low. The reason why we created the investment pool or in pool was that we, the county, was able to purchase long-term investments previously. And that long-term investment has a higher yield. But we wanted the taxing district to benefit from that as well. And that's why we created the pool. At that time, a few years ago, before COVID hit, the long-term strategy was able to benefit for the taxing district too, as you mentioned before. But unfortunately, it backfires now because of the drastic change in the economy.
Sure. And I understand how we got here. Right. I think what I'm a little bit worried about, and maybe I just have to toughen up. I just got done saying tough, be tough. And then I'm wimpy, but maybe the conversation that I'd like to have though, is we really have the ability to, we bring in enough money that we can be in all these other funds. Some of these junior taxing districts that are all in on our funds don't have the ability to diversify to take advantage of the higher interest rates. Should we buy them out? Like, we put our money into the lower yield funds. Their money can come out then. I don't know the rules about that. Their money can come out and they have the ability to chase these higher rates because they're locked in.
Right.
We can pull out. I mean, we have enough money that we're other places to offset that low rate. But they're not
losing money. They're just earning lower interest. They're gaining money anyway. But yeah, you're right that they are losing out on the options that are available out there. The only thing we can do is, if you want to go that route, and we can discuss this at the financial meeting group. But the only route we can do is sell off the long-term bonds, which will take as a loss.
Yeah.
Then we actually lose money.
Sell them if we just put our money in to replace their money. I mean, isn't that like an internal whose money is in the fund? We're not. Right. We keep the same amount of money in the fund.
Right, but the liquidity, the money, excess money that we have, is in the LGIP, and right now it's at 10%.
No, I get
so
it.
You want to do, if you want to invest in LGIP, which
if we bought them out, we need the liquidity, and that's why we need to sell.
And that'll be
I'm awesome. With you. That was what I was not saying.
So okay. One other
also you made well you figured out also you made a very good point of the fact that they're not losing money, and in reality they're not as tied to, well, some of them are tied to sales tax, like transit is a sales. I mean, what I'm worried about is that they're, we say, well, you're still making money in these funds. Right. But they're taking the same hits we're taking in the economy, right? Like, we're using interest rates to offset lower sales tax revenue. But unless the 1.9% is higher than what transit's not collecting in sales tax revenue, they're losing money in this market, because what the market has traded high interest rates for sales tax. I mean, it's trying to
revenue in August was pretty good.
We expected the interest rates to start coming down, and then August gave us a and so they're not, right? They're holding up here. So we're in this place where we had hoped that this would start to bounce out about now, and it's not. And one thing that might be helpful just to is that retrospective that you often get from investors, which is, this is what your 1 year performance looked like. This is what your 3 year, 5 year, because it might help our junior taxing districts understand what their retrospective performance was and how well they did during COVID, instead of a point in time look at this. Because I think my anxiety is at this point in time, or this last year, where we've been significantly lower. And perhaps, I don't know, if we had a retrospective look at performance of our ICTIP, we might see a different pattern that might give at least information to our junior taxing districts that may or may not help them understand.
I'm just worried because we're making our budget work on increased interest earnings. That's how our budget's going to get across the finish line. Mm-hmm. We traded other things in the economy for high interest rates. If those junior taxing districts don't have that same option, right? That's what I'm worried about. That's really what I'm worried about. That's it. You're working with them. You know the rules better than me. I'm not trying to micromanage it. I just want to be clear that, I mean, that's the reason you raise interest rates is because you want to slow aspects of the other part of the economy down.
I'm actually okay with the fact that our pool is a fairly steady, dependable pool. There was those months back in 2020 and early in 2021 when everybody else was in the toilet and we were
right.
That's
in good shape.
Yeah.
And even now we're not, you know, we're still 2 points below most of the other or many of the other investments. However, we're still increasing.
If you look at
I think it's the trend graph, line yeah. of the disparity that Commissioner Johnson and I are concerned about is right. the disparity in the trend line. And
I understand.
And I think maybe if this could come back to the Finance Committee to unpack a little bit I don't want to lose money to create liquidity. I understand that argument. I don't think Commissioner Johnson does either. Right. So, but what in here is I don't know. I mean, I just want to raise it. I don't have any solutions.
I just don't want every junior taxing district going out there asking for a tax increase because they can't make their budget work,
sure.
right?
Sure.
And that's what they'll do is say, we don't have enough money, let's tax people more. Well,
there, yeah, unfortunately, I don't see any options until we have more money to invest. And whether property tax money comes in and we are able to put that to LGIP, that would increase our rate, definitely. Again, that's temporary. Unless people are spending that money, then we'll drop back down again.
Fair.
But and another option is that if there are investments out there that are maturing within the next year, and once they mature, we're going to go ahead and definitely repurchase out there.
We'll see it grow.
Right, and it will increase as soon as we purchase more bonds out there that are available with a high interest.
So let's talk about the Finance Committee. Mm-hmm. Let's ask Sheila to be here in person because it's easier and she's just across the way. And let's unpack this further because I think it sounds like it's a shared concern of just right. making sure we're serving our customers to
right,
some degree.
Definitely. Okay. So we'll continue and I'll make it brief. The county's portion of the pool is at 55% at 126 million. Taxing district, their portion is about 45% at 105 million. Total for the pool as of August 31st is 231 million. The monies that we held in Key Bank is at 7.9 million. Heritage Bank or Whitgun Bank, we have 1.6 million. Total in the bank is 9.6 million. As mentioned earlier, 10% of our investment pool is investment in the LGIP, and 25% is maturing within a year, assuming no calls. This satisfies our investment pool requirement of 20% of the portfolio as a minimum. Yes.
How is it that our total cash balance? I'm sure this is a really mm-hmm. obvious question. How is it that our total cash balance is different than our fund balance? Anyone know that?
Fund balance.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I want to think it feels like it should be clear, but I don't. That's an interesting question.
Look, I don't know what the difference in the
terminology. Can you work with budget to answer that question? So we're operating on kind of an assumption that in current expense, we've got 12 to 13 million in.
Fund
balance, right?
Right.
Savings account.
But they may be in investments. as opposed to in KeyBank. They may be in the LGIP or the
IT. It says total cash balances. So we have $9 million in cash, and then right. we just add the investment total to that, and that's what our assets are. Because we have other funds. I mean, that $12 million is just current expense.
That's right.
So I'm trying to see, like, well, where's the rest of that money?
It's an asset and liability
question. I think I'm not knowing how to read your report compared to the budget.
And I need to know more about what the fund balance you're talking about. So I have to compare it with.
Because different funds have it. So, I mean, we should have upwards of $30 million, I'm guessing, when you put roads in there and all the other funds.
Total money.
I see.
Right? And so it's like, how do you see all of that? Because if I looked at this, I'd say, well, you have $9 million fund balance. But that's not.
Yeah, you're talking about just the county portion.
That's not our fund balance.
$9 million cash. It is total for taxing districts. It's all lumped up in
there. Also, not our money. Right, their money too.
We don't go ahead and have the cash for the county only versus taxing districts. It's all
really that there. $9 million includes the taxing districts.
So money. I think what I'd like to be able to see on here. Is to at some point get a gut check between the numbers that you're giving us from a treasurer standpoint and what we're budgeting against, right? Because I don't see alignment. I know it's somewhere. I'm just not understanding how to read this.
Right, right. Okay.
I think it's a great question. And because it's like we're talking about what you manage, and that cash is not just our cash, it's everybody's cash.
Right.
And how does what you present to us fit within the assets and liabilities accounting that Susan gives us?
It would have been a great question my first year in office, not my 11th year in office, but
I did look in now noticed.
Okay, yeah.
I'll bring that up.
I just need to understand how they're different. I don't understand the difference between reality and budgeting in terms of actual cash.
Yeah. Okay. And whether it's hours and, okay. But yes, I'll take a look at that with Susan, budget manager. As of August 31st, 2023 property tax levies for current expense roads and conservation were at 56% collected. And I'm sure that number will increase as the coming months come with October 31st deadline.
Do you think you'll hit the goal?
Normally we will. normally in the past years, it will be 98% collected by December.
It's the same as last year. Yeah. Last year was 56 at the same time.
Right. It's consistent. Foreclosure, starting out with the 80 properties subject to foreclosure as of August 31st, it comes down to 13. The certificate of delinquency was filed on August 7th for the 13 properties and if it all goes through, hopefully we'll get some that will pay up and that they'll take it out of foreclosure. But if not, our online auction is on December 5th. Mm. The number of reprocessed.
Yes. So none of those properties are unbuildable properties, are they, Tony?
I do not look at whether they're unbuildable or not. I'm assuming some probably is unbuildable. There are six property within that 13 that have structures on there. Some is a actual resident house. I'm hopeful that
I'm not in support of the county selling unbuildable lots without the board talking about those lots.
I think we looked at that a few weeks back on what the counties can do prior to putting those properties on the online foreclosure auction. But I'll revisit that again and get back.
We did, Tony and I did discuss that. And I think I'm not 100% sure, but I think we need to compete is what.
Yeah.
It has to go to auction.
It has
to. We could be the best bidder, but we can't just not do the process, but I think you should.
I thought we pay the delinquent taxes and take it. We can't do that's not no. how I thought that's what you could do.
No.
If, as government.
I think as government, unless I'm incorrect on that, as government, we cannot participate on the online auction.
Can't even participate.
I can double check on the RCW on that.
Good information to have. What is the
just paid the taxes, we took it.
Not only for tax title. Once the auction is completed and those properties are not sold at auction, then it becomes tax title, which means it goes to the Island County for temporary holding, and those become tax title properties. And at that time, the county can purchase those tax title properties by paying the minimum bid, which is the delinquent taxes.
And then we're responsible for them, and then we have to maintain them, and then we have to enforce. We have less tools to enforce when we own the
property. Maybe our solution is at the online auction that we put something red right across it that says undevelopable lot. Like, we really do the buyer beware portion of that. Maybe that is a solution we can
do diligence.
Yeah, we do have notes on that, that buyer beware, that the there are things about that property that need to be aware of. But I don't know about having it printed out or bolded. As I can double check with our online bidder.
So I'll tell you this, the problem, Tony. Maybe I've already said this to you. I told my colleague. Mm-hmm. We had a number of properties down in the Useless Bay area that are unbuildable. This is a year or two ago. They were unbuildable because it's in a wetland and it's, you know, protected and blah, blah, blah. And so we Wanda brought it to us. We said, yes, go ahead, do the, we'll make sure people know they're unbuildable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently we're not the only ones to advertise when lots are put out to sell. And it was advertised in other places, these lots were, and didn't advertise the fact that they were unbuildable. And someone got a real deal. They got this great lot in Useless Bay for $20,000. Man, what a deal. And he went down there and he put in a shack and he can't get a septic and he can't get to this and he can't get to that. So he's just
living.
He's just living like he lived on Hoffman Road or something. He's just living that way, only he's doing buckets and such. And so that's really not what the Board of County Commissioners wants to have happen in those kinds of properties.
It would be the same as if a property owner that has an unbuildable lot sells it to another person, and the buyer goes ahead and didn't realize or did not overlook the fact it's unbuildable and they build things on there.
Sure.
Wouldn't that be something that...
It's the same. We're just trying to eliminate our headaches.
Right.
Because when people buy unbuildable lots... Yeah. They spend lots of time calling us, explaining to us how their lot is buildable, even though it doesn't perk.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll double check again with our online company that we have and check with if there's options to highlight the fact that it is unbuildable.
But the other thing is it's unbuildable today. That doesn't mean forever. We might get new technology and things good to go. And... But I'm with you. It's like, or like steep slopes or things where it's like, look, we know this is not going to end well for us in the long run as an organization and entity. It's kind of like intervene with the dollars you have versus paying out the claim that comes.
I have a citizen who will be talking about her property on October 4th down there. She gets flooded every year, and right behind her is a bluff, and there's no way for emergency vehicles to get down to her house and this and that and the other thing. And I'm like, really, nobody should be living there. Really, ultimately, no one should be living there. Her children are trying to get her to sell the property. So, okay, so she sells the property. The problem doesn't go away.
Right.
It ends up being, it's a county problem, ultimately. It's a county problem.
This is the climate resiliency conversation. Are we, and I don't mean it harsh, this isn't for you, but... Okay, I'm not supposed to do this now. Michael is going to lecture me about the tangenting off topic. So I'm going to hold this because I'll remember.
Okay.
But, you know, are we buying out wealthy people on the shoreline? Is that what government's going to do with taxpayer dollars from people who live in apartments in Oak Harbor?
And we're we could recognize, and I'm tangenting with her because I care about this, that we recognize their responsibility to mitigate against climate issues themselves and take personal responsibility for raising their houses, adjusting their infrastructure, and all of that.
It's going to get hard.
It is going to get hard, but
and Tony, you're
it's a complicated conversation.
You're going to auction some of these off because they're just going to walk away.
All right.
That's how I tied it back to
you. We tied it back, and we'll let you keep going.
And then I acknowledged the tangent that was not appropriate.
Well, I started it.
The number of read affidavits processed in August was 367 compared to 282 in July, which is a great increase there, and comparable to 431 in August of 2022.
I mean, that's not terrible.
No, it's surprising. We got quite a bit in August.
And is that just for that year to date? It says year to date, so I could just look at the thing that says year to date. Yeah. It's a pretty significant difference, though.
Yeah.
I don't have 2022. I think
we have a different screen.
So we went from 2022 at this time of year, or okay, 2023 is year to date. 2022, which is total for the year.
Are you looking at the chart?
I'm looking at the chart
with the box.
Okay.
I think there's a typo in the box.
Yeah. I think 2020, the second 2021 is 2023. So that 2,314 isn't comparing year to date. It's comparing year to date to year end.
Correct. Yeah.
It's not bad. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So let's look at the charts. So the first chart I have is for the investment pool comparable to other investment types. The second table I have is a list of participants in the investment pool. And you did mention about Island Transit, and yes, they have quite a bit in the pool at 55 million.
We'll take questions about soon.
Next, we have the list of the graph of the investment interest earnings for August.
Remind me again, Tony, where you expect we're going to land by the end of the year?
I put down it's about 1.8, but it looks like it's going to be steadily, because I never really know if the federal fund rate is going to be dropping down or not.
We have 1.6 for the end of this year, and you're saying 1.8 for 2024, right?
No, we have 1.6 today.
You're right. And I think a few months ago, I projected 1.8 as of end of year, but okay. It's going to be.
I'm with you. Yeah. I'm losing track of myself. Thank you, Melanie.
So if the rates continues, then another 4 months, that will be bringing us to over 2 million.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Can you check with Susan to see if we're over 2 million in investments, what that means to our fund balance? I mean, I think that's a pickup in ongoing operating, or it's at least a pickup. At minimum, it's a fund balance pickup of one-time money we have.
It is, but I think that she's already forecasted verify.
Forecasted it 1.8 or forecasted it 2, because he's saying 2. Just double check.
Yeah, I will. But she.
Because we put 1.8 in for 2024 interest. We didn't put 2 in.
Yeah, so right, we put in the 1.8, and I believe that she forecasted where it's actually headed. But again, I will check.
This next table is different. I added in there just because there are a lot of interest about the pool. It shows the current rate, of course, and the LGIP rate, mm-hmm. and the net earnings for the pool itself, as well as a 12-month moving average between the pool, the LGIP rate, gross earnings for the pool, and a moving average for a 2-year U.S. Treasury. And it also lists down a bit about the type of investment that we have out there. Mm-hmm. Let me know if this is something that is helpful and informative, and I can continue doing so.
I like it. It's just more information.
Next, we have a number of affidavits processed by month. It's a list comparable to the previous 5 years, or 4 years, excuse me. Next, we have a chart of the number earnings for REIT excess collections for 2018-2023. There is an increase, of course, for the last few months, or actually a lot this month in August.
Where do you think we'll land on REIT? Do you have a gut?
That I don't know. It just all over the place, and unfortunately, it's not something I can just forecast on.
No, I didn't.
It's still weird.
And last, this is a graph of what we have in excise earned revenues through August by year. This is comparable to the other years, prior years.
2021.
I was here earlier, and I was reminded when I was watching everyone's on the previous agenda that I should be monitoring these work sessions more. It's just I have a hard time finding time to do so. And I understand that your time is valuable. Let me know if it's these information is something I can just forward to you, or if I can continually come by and just present this to you.
I like both. I mean, you've been giving us these reports as well in advance. And I mean, if the board says, gosh, we've got agenda and we're going to bump you, we can always reach out. But frankly, from my perspective, having you here gave me the opportunity to raise some questions and talk together. So yeah. I don't want to not have you here. And I appreciate your time, knowing how busy your team is. Are you fully staffed now?
We are fully staffed now. We lost our foreclosure deputy she moved on to a different department 2 months ago, and we hired someone. But during the meantime, Don Thomas, who was doing supplements and such, and tax statements, was able to back up that process. But while she's doing that and training the foreclosure deputy, she is behind on supplements. So we're 5 months behind on supplements, mm-hmm. which is very,
yeah. We know what happens when that gets too.
Right.
We got to figure that out. You're on right.
Previously, we were behind 2 years ago, quite a bit behind, but my predecessor, Wanda Grown, because she was very, quick in doing her treasury functions, she was able to help with supplements, and she was processing supplements for the last year and a half, and that brings it up current. But I'm not able, not at the point where I can start doing supplements as well. I will be learning it though within the next week, same as my chief deputy, see how we can assist to bring that supplements up to date.
So we don't have any money this year for budgeting things. So I'm saying that. And so I'm acknowledging right. what I'm about to say but falling behind on supplements has significant consequences organizationally.
Yes.
So I'm not sure how I feel about that being an expectation of an elected sheriff, right? Like mm-hmm. every time you're new, there's a lot to catch up on. Mm-hmm. You have to manage the people. You've got to learn how to present right. to the board. You've got to manage the investment pool.
Right.
My expectation is that you're not doing tasks, right? Mm-hmm. That there's not time to do tasks.
Right.
So I would encourage you structurally to mm-hmm. figure out what the staffing needs are to yeah. deliver the services and keep that moving. Mm-hmm. Whether is there times of year that we need to bring somebody in who maybe has the experience that we can,
yeah.
you know, do mm-hmm. temporarily? Do mm-hmm. we need half-time person? Do we need a full-time person? But I just know that when those supplements got behind, and then people did real estate transactions and things weren't cleaned up, and then all of a sudden the new owner gets a bill for like yes. $7,000, yes. that did not go well for us.
I did not. Yes, I was there.
Yeah.
and I really understand the result is for falling behind. I do understand that 2 years ago, we had a 9-person staff in the treasurer's office. And when we hired someone, moved that one position to Camino, we do lose that assistance that person provide for supplements too. We are trying to reach out. Well, the person in Camino is asking if she can help too. And we're seeing if it's something that she can, especially the remote way that she's over in Camino, we're in Coolville, and there's a lot of paperwork that goes, might be needed, going back and forth. So we're trying to see if there's something that she can assist with that as well.
Well, with all due respect, supplements are a high priority. Mm-hmm. It's not having somebody so it looks like we have someone.
Right.
If that person can't work to serve the needs of the office. So I'm just encouraging you to think through your staffing structure and bring us back a plan of what you need.
Okay. I'm with Commissioner Johnson. I remember a number of years ago, I know you remember too, Tony, when we ended up bringing Dan into the office, and it was because there were thousands of supplements behind.
Yes.
And so and we don't want to ever, ever get there again. If we need to look at a short-term person or something to help the office.
Or even at a short time for a period of time to catch up, bring Morgan over from the other island. Right. That's what other departments do that go back and forth, is they'll bring somebody who's based over there and bring them over here to catch up on certain things. So that's an option you can do as well, is to say, we really need to catch up on this. We need you to be over here 2 days a week or whatever you decide, right? To catch up.
Design the office the way it works for you.
Okay.
Ask for what you need. Don't put on yourself, well, it's my responsibility to fill in all of these holes. That's not actually your responsibility. You need to be in a position to manage, oversee. I mean, all of those big thematic things that happens in that office.
Right.
If you start getting sucked into the day-to-day, you're not doing the leadership role. So you need to step back and figure out how that office works for you.
Okay.
Where you're not running it for somebody else anymore.
And if you need our help with staff, at least a period of time, talk to us.
But okay. That's you got to bring it to us the way you need that office to work. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. All right. Next up is Connie Bowers on critical drainage, critical areas, GIS.
Hi, this is Connie Bowers, the Public Works Director and County Engineer for Island County. And I'm bringing this subject back. We talked about it about a couple months ago, early in summer. This is regarding critical drainage areas, updating the critical drainage areas. I've broken it down into a couple different sections today. So as we've discussed before, the critical drainage areas, when they were formed in 98, when we digitize them, they don't really line up well with our parcel layer. And then there's been zoning changes over the years. And so now they're just not ideally located. So attached in the packet is an updated series of maps that are in alphabetical order. And they show the historic one, the one that's currently adopted by the county in hash mark, and then the proposed one in pink outlined. And so that's one of the first.
What's the consequence of making the change?
The consequence of making the change is that it represents current zoning, current parcel boundaries. So there will be some parcels that won't be in and some parcels that will be in critical drainage areas. They'll switch.
So it for the people on the ground, it could change whether or not they're in a critical drainage area.
Both positive and negative, or both in and out. So
not based
way.
On reality, though, based on the map.
Based on what we've defined the critical drainage areas as being.
Got it. And we're aligning those by parcels. I'm with you. I got it. Okay.
Yes. And then sometimes the zoning has changed over years. Rates have come and gone.
Right.
Right. And so that's one. It's one option for the board if they just want to update the critical drainage areas to represent current conditions and recommendations by the permitting departments. That's an option. And then the second thing that we would be talking about is making the GIS layer the legal layer, the legal representation of that data. So we do have a digitized version of the current critical drainage areas on our ICGO maps. And so it's available to the public and to our staff as well. And that's usually what they refer to when they are looking up critical drainage areas. They don't go back to the paper maps.
Mm-hmm.
But we can certainly print these maps and make them a paper map resource and still be looking online.
Can I ask some questions about the resolution?
Yes.
So the first thing you talk about is what you're saying here, which is to update, add the critical drainage area layer. And then you have a request to restrict that it can't, not just anybody can change that.
No, the first one is to update the critical drainage area boundaries. And so that is basically adopting these
maps that are depicted in the package in front of you. Uh-huh. And it could be just a paper version of it. The second one is saying, and let's make the a restricted layer be that legal representation of the data, the legal holder of that data. And one of that, did that answer your question?
Yeah. Well, it sets the stage for my next question. So it says, when an event occurs which changes that boundary, it prompts a change to the GIS layer. How and who will make that change?
So in the second, one of the things that was asked at the previous meeting was to put together a GIS policy, and that's the first attachment in your packet that talks about the process of when a change is made and how it progresses through the, ooh, sorry, I did have a couple handouts. Minor changes, they are shown in blue. Minor changes shown in blue.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at. That's what I'm looking at. And that's what this is what I'm looking at and asking questions about.
There we go. Perfect. Okay. Yes. And so I have coordinated this with both the health department and the planning department, as well as GIS. And so I think what you're saying is, just for the record, there are minor changes on this handout that are shown in blue for the board. So we're talking about when an event it occurs, which changes the boundary, it prompts a change. And so they provide some examples, those zoning changes, segregations, boundary line adjustments. Once the board adopts that change by a resolution, or if that's something done in the planning commission, I'm not all sure how the different ways it happens, then there's going to be an adopting document. There's something that goes with right. it, and that gets given to the GIS manager, and that way they can reference all those resolution numbers or okay. adopting document numbers so that it's tracked well, and only the GIS manager would be able to change the actual layer.
I have a couple of questions. It's
for either way. That all seems safe. What about if someone determines there's a change in on the ground conditions where somebody needs to be in a critical area?
So they would go through that formal process, either the planning director or health director, whoever is promoting that, or if it's coming from the public, that process that would normally change the zoning or the designation goes through its normal processes that it has in the past. And so, then it's just given to the GIS to implement.
I mean, okay. So what you described before, I understood, which is if there's a change in the boundary line adjustment, if there's change in the parcel line, if there's a change, like, so that we're keeping contiguous properties within an area. But if something's not in a, parcel's not in a critical drainage issue now, and a planner determines that it should be, that's not a zone, that's not a, that's, I guess you're saying you want to put something in the overlay, because the critical, maybe I'm not understanding. The critical drainage area isn't a zone, it's an overlay, right? The zoning is what you can do to develop the parcel underneath. This is a, like an overlay that says, here's information about these parcels.
You're going to go outside my knowledge base okay. a bit here. So I understand. Too, so I understand that the zoning reflects into the critical drainage areas somehow. And I don't have a good connection for you. And we can certainly come back if we need to go into that more.
I think what I want to understand is what the on the ground impact is. And to do that, I need to know the impact to the properties, right? So that might be a planning question.
So for the first item, looking at the changes to the adopting maps, you should be able to see, and if you need it printed out or anything, you should be able to see which parcels are in and which parcels are out, where that change has been. Mm-hmm. And I think some of them are fairly minor changes, but some are big areas like the Clinton raid. You can kind of see there's a big gap that used to be there and now it's not there anymore. So all those parcels in the middle don't have to do the more detailed drainage narratives, don't have to do all the requirements of a critical drainage area.
So, I mean, that's partly what I was trying to understand is like, what does it mean to somebody if you're in or if you're out? So the Clinton raid, I understand like if we move things based on parcel lines, but this is basically saying some of these areas are out.
Yes.
What was the driver to take these areas out, and what does it mean to those properties?
So the going back to the, I'm flipping to the background, which is on the second page, and it talks to that just at a very high level, saying in 98 we developed these rural areas of intense development that had existing drainage issues, and there were 22 at the time, and now we're down to 15. What has happened over time, I think, is that we've changed. I'll have to go back. Sorry. I think it's that we've changed the RAID definitions by the planning, through the planning department, and that takes them out of this designation.
It takes them out of the RAID?
No, it takes them out of the critical drainage area.
I think it takes them out of both.
That takes them out of both. How can you change a RAID with a critical drainage area?
I'll come back.
We need planning.
Yeah, we're going to need planning.
I mean, I don't want to be difficult, but going to be able to move forward on the decision unless I understand the ramifications of the decision. Because it seems like, yeah, let's align it and let's make the layer public and let GIS do it. But I don't know the consequence of what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
Sorry. I just don't know.
That's fine. I'm not that familiar with the way that planning makes those changes either. And these are, you know, outdated. When these were originally formed in 98, they haven't been updated to review the drainage conditions in those areas. So at some point, they probably need to be looked at in that regards as well.
Can I just ask a clarifying map question?
Yes.
So look at Goss Lake. Page 23.
Where I live in a critical drainage area.
So I'm asking, what I look at there is that the historical critical drainage area was smaller, and now it's actually a larger critical drainage area. Now go back to, was it Clinton that actually went the other direction?
Wait, I don't have it smaller. I have it different.
It's different.
Well, that's why I'm trying to understand how to read the map.
Okay, good. Because I was like, I don't understand it the same way you.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand. So I'm asking a question. I look at map number on page 19 with Clinton, and it looks like this is why I'm checking my assumptions, Jill. It looks like the historic critical area drainage area was bigger, and now if you look at the pink, it's smaller, and on Goss Lake, it looked the opposite to me. That's why I'm asking if I'm even reading these correctly.
You are reading them correctly. There are definite changes, you know, more than just the boundary line adjustments. And most of that is, I understand, through the planning department that things have changed. The zoning or the rural areas of intense development.
Okay.
And I don't know that area well enough to talk to it.
In a couple of these maps, area that had been one critical drainage area has actually now become two. That happens in the Menlo area and also Fan Cove. So I'm really interested in how that affects the RAID.
Okay. I'll circle back and bring that portion of, and make sure that I have somebody from planning who knows more about it to talk to that side.
I know
of things.
Jonathan's coming down, but since we're already behind, are you guys okay if we bring this back?
I'm sorry. It seems like it's pretty straightforward, but I need to spend some time with planning, understanding what it means, especially because it impacts RAIDs, which we're super protective of. And I know it's critical drainage, but what does it mean when you take it away, when you add it in to development potential, especially when you start talking in alignment with those RAIDs, right? So I just need to understand it.
I am never really fond of being dumb online in public. So if you and Jonathan, I would like to talk to you together alone offline so that I can ask my less articulate questions sometimes.
Okay.
And then, I think I'd like to have this come back. I'm not sure what the implications of all this are, and we're already behind. So thank you, Jonathan, for showing up. I'd like to bring it back if that's okay. Okay,
all right.
Let's bring it back then.
I will. And then there's one other item that Fred Snodderly, our Assistant Public Works Director, will talk to.
Okay. Fred Snodderly, our Assistant Public Works Director, would you like to come up and talk to us?
Sure. Really fast. I will make it as expedient as possible.
You want to get a grant?
Yes, ma'am.
We're in support of that.
And it's a new grant specifically, specifically designed for parks to actually address deferred maintenance. So we would be applying for $55,000 to rehabilitate the road, the Dendron Park bathroom.
To which one?
Thank you.
To which one?
Thank you.
Rhododendron.
Rhododendron.
Yep.
So it's a beautiful
park. So that's
all my complainers.
So that is, it takes, it will take a resolution to basically go with our application. So we'd like to move this to consent.
Yeah, I'm good. Good.
Yes, yes.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
That was very quick. Yep. Well done. Now, Catherine. I got to get to your section.
You need a new hearing examiner?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's not super controversial unless it costs a lot more money.
Well, we have a certain budgeted amount. Right now, we don't have any appeals pending. We have a decision pending, but we don't have any appeals pending. I'm working with Pete Smiley from the prosecuting attorney's office to make sure we do everything so that when we get that final decision from our old hearing examiner, that it's all done and taken care of and legal. And this is a draft agreement with the new hearing examiner, Whatcom Law Group. The main person there, Rajiv Majumdar, has actually been a pro tem hearing examiner for us in the past. And so he does a lot of work up in Whatcom County with the municipalities and the county. He sits as a judge pro tem for the courts there. Really experienced. He and I've had a couple of conversations, and I think that he would serve our county very well.
So that kind of goes to my question about the role of a hearing examiner. And so what is the role of a hearing examiner? Because you're interpreting policy and code, right?
Code.
You're interpreting code. And our code in many instances is ambiguous by design. How do we know? I mean, I'm going to probably approve this, but how do I know if this guy is in alignment with board values or not? And is that even an appropriate question?
Right. So statutorily, this person is supposed to be very much independent.
Yeah.
Basically, land use is primarily land use decisions are the ones that the hearing examiner looks at. We'll look at the code. One of the reasons that you want lawyers is because typically lawyers live in gray. And so that they have the ability to look at those statutes and find out, or those codes and find out, okay, is this a legitimate request based on the code language and that kind of thing. My understanding from his prior work here is that, you know, he performed really well and was able to walk through and explain those kinds of things. He's also very... he wants to make sure that he's performing all of the obligations, including reporting to you, all of you, keeping you up to date. If he sees something within the code under the statutes, if he sees somebody and our code, if he sees somebody in something in code that maybe needs to be clarified, he can bring that to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a couple of conversations and gotten in depth a little bit, and he's very comfortable performing that kind of function as well.
So partly where I'm asking, and Greg, who I have a lot of respect for, but has sometimes interpreted things to maybe be more in alignment with his interpretation than the board's interpretation, right? So the board may say, well, we see this gray area and we want to push it this direction. And Greg, who is arguably very intelligent, sees the same opportunity to prohibit something because of the ambiguity. And that's where I was asking about like our role in picking someone who culturally aligns. Like if we're saying, and by the way, this is not necessarily the full board's opinion. If we're saying we want someone to interpret towards property rights, development, opportunities versus somebody who's like, the code really restricts your ability to do this, this, and this, and this because it's silent or it's gray or it's whatever. Those ideologies come to the table with each person. So I'm trying to understand how much influence we have or should have in the selection of a hearing examiner in their ideological alignment.
Are they supposed to be aligned?
They are not.
That's what I'm trying to, because each person comes with their bias, right? So I don't want somebody who's like, you can't. I want that person. I want a person who's like, you shouldn't, you can't, you can go for it, right?
Yeah, in part, I think part of what we're looking for in a hearing examiner is some impartiality so that they're not actually doing what you want them to do. And they're also not biased on the part of what the opposite of what you want to do happens. And having somebody who can look at our code and whatever the issue is and come up with a decision that is supportive of the code, you know, that's their job. Okay. So if a homeowner is asking for something or a property owner is asking for something and it's supported by the code, I would expect the hearing examiner would rule in favor of the homeowner. I think part of the reason we don't have any pending appeals right now is because I think your planning department is doing some of those things, right? And it's going to take time because it's a kind of a change. But as the planning and building part of planning and community development continues to hear what your policy as a board is, you're going to see changes. It's just they won't be wholesale changes. They're going to have to come incrementally.
When they're interpreting, so the planning directors or historically our directors have some, whether it's planning or public works, have some ability to have an interpretive role in their job as directors, right?
I would think so.
Yes. So if something's appealed to the hearing examiner and the planning director interpreted it X, Y, that's part of our due process. They may or may not support the interpretation by the planning director. What is their, okay, just want to make sure I understood that right. And then what is their role in interpreting legislative intent? Because there is sometimes where, and I'm going to give an example, and you may not agree with me on this example, but I'm going to give the example of ADUs. When we passed the ADU legislation, my legislative intent was to add more long-term housing stock into our county, and it's not turned out to have been that. Now we have a lot of our ADUs are being used for short-term rentals, and so we have a conversation before us. But if there was someone who said, and we didn't clarify it in code, so what's happening now is totally allowable. It's just an example. I'm not trying to litigate that example. But
I don't even know if that's true. I mean, I'm not going to argue with you, but I don't even know if that's true. I don't know if we even factually know if that's true.
Well, that's what we're hearing sometimes.
Yeah.
So,
we hear it.
But to get to my question, my question is still, do they interpret... Does the hearing examiner take on legislative intent, and how would they do that in code, or do they just look at what's written in code? Because I think that's sometimes what isn't clear when we write code is what was the intent and did we clarify that enough in advance? Something came up this morning where there was an example given of the intent wasn't put into the code that was passed.
Yeah. So typically whenever, you know, it's been my experience that they're not going to go into legislative intent without some kind of ambiguity that can't be solved by their analysis of the language.
So that answers a big question for me on something.
Right.
Okay.
Now, again, having talked to Mr. Majumdar, I think what you might find if there were something that was on the edge on that is maybe a report back to you as the Board of County Commissioners on some clarification or, an amending the code,
okay,
that kind of thing.
Okay.
I would add from my experience with hearing examiners is they interpret what the code says, but they also are very receptive of the information that is provided by the public as well as staff. And staff is very informed on past practice, typical interpretation, those kinds of things. And staff should and does, I'm sure, provide that information through staff reports and other, yeah, other information. Hearing examiners, though my experience, and not with Mr. Majumdar, I actually know him well because he was a prosecutor, a contract prosecutor in Blaine, but not as a hearing examiner. He, other hearing examiners have said, well, probably almost these exact words, if that's what they meant, that's what they should have written. That's not in what the board passed or what the council passed. So they don't expand the law to mean different things in my experience. That if you, for example, I think your example is a good one. If it was supposed to not allow short-term rentals,
whether
it should have said,
not,
it doesn't, it should have said that. Would a hearing examiner,
and
pretty
that's fair.
Narrow in my experience, they're pretty narrow in their interpretation.
I don't think we changed the number. I think we just changed the size to just to be like,
it was meant to be an example.
I know, but
I do remember sitting watching where you have testimony from the public, you have testimony from planning or public works or whomever is in play. And then they make their decision. And that quote of, if you meant it, you should have written it down, I think is good instruction for us, not to just assume that because we talked about something that way, that everybody's going to interpret it that way. We need to put our intention into the words in code. So that's helpful. I'm supportive.
Give more
questions.
I had one more question. So I understand the role of the hearing examiner. But then as we talk about code change recommendations that could come back to us, and we're going into this comprehensive plan process where there is an opportunity to write code based on policy recommendations or different types of things, is the hearing examiner positioned to participate in that process, or that's a different type of legal input that the board would need to develop its codes in a way that's where you have like the finding of facts and the this is the language that you need to accomplish this outcome so that a hearing examiner could say yes or no to it? I mean, do they go that far, or we're just like, look, your role is interpretation and then recommendations back to us based on difficulties you had reaching your decision in your code?
Yeah, I would say they don't go that far. Like I said, it's allowable for them if there is something that comes up that looks like it's an ambiguity to make a recommendation back, but their responsibility is to interpret the code as it relates to each specific
That's what
case.
I thought.
Yeah.
But it also speaks to a gap that we still have. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still need to, this conversation again highlights that gap we still have. Okay, we're not going to solve it today. We're going to move this to consent.
Ask a compliance question. Due to unavoidable circumstances, we had some challenges in timeliness of decisions. And I want to make sure that this contract is clear about those responsibilities to meet the legal requirements that we have on these decisions. I was kind of looking through it.
It's laid out, and there's also like a damages provision included with like a terminate.
So it's a little bit stronger than the last. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think we'll have an issue.
I don't want to revisit the past. I just want to make sure the future's better.
Yep.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Jones, I think you're up.
So I've been waiting all morning.
I think some people in the audience have been waiting all morning.
Yes, they have. So, what I have before you is the animal code, Title VI animal code, animals code being revised to become Title VI animal welfare with a number of changes. It came back from the code reviewer's office with the PA in a underlined and strike through format. So it shows you what's added and changed or deleted. And it is what you had seen before, just blended into our existing code with those additions, deletions, et cetera. And the one question that I wasn't able to answer last time we talked about this, because I wasn't prepared, I had just gotten this back the morning before, was, yeah, the last version that you all had me send to the code revisor did include licensing for private kennels. So that was the question that you had, Commissioner Johnson. So that is in here. But otherwise, I don't really have anything to report. It's what you last saw and what you agreed was ready to go to the code revisor before it come back. So my recommendation is that unless there are changes that you wish to make, we schedule a public hearing for October 17th for this.
Can I point out something that I think is a weakness in our system? So from a legal standpoint and an enforcement standpoint, I don't know what this gets us, right? And I don't have a way to ask that question necessarily. I mean, I have asked the question, which is why I know to ask the question. But this kind of isn't in context to our reality, right? So we're listing out all these things that the RCW are already supports, and we're creating language that gets us what exactly, right? So in the case of, oh my God, my mind. Yeah, but I forgot her name when I know it. But in the Hasty Lake situation, there's nothing in this code that would change the outcome, right? Like, what would be different? Because we had the right language to go in there in extreme circumstances. Yeah. We had the right language to go in there before it got so extreme, to be honest. We didn't have an animal control officer.
I think we didn't have any kind of kennel expectation, kennel licensing expectation before.
And if the Hasty Lake situation had enough dogs and or cats in combination to trigger the private kennel licensing requirement, then it may have been found and interacted with sooner. But the PA has said to me numerous times, and I think here in front of you more than once, that this isn't really solving that situation. We have the ability to do those things. We have the ability to prosecute under the current code. This clarifies things. It does change some things, but it's not like that happened because we didn't have this law. And he also said it won't solve that from ever happening again, because sure, it's a human nature. It's a human behavioral kind of issue. We will see that happen again and have to interact again. This hopefully makes it a little easier, a little better. And then that private kennel piece may be when someone's essentially hoarding dogs and or cats, that may be the trigger.
I hear you. What I'm trying to understand is, like, when you say there's some differences. So I see the language. I'm trying to understand the differences. What do we get? What are we getting?
We're getting the kennel licensing.
So this is about this is
so those about we're getting kennels. Those two things. Mm-hmm. We are getting.
We're getting clarification through the use of terms.
Yes, we are getting clarification by having more definitions specifically listed here. We are strengthening the requirement of bonding for care rather than, I think, relying on the judge to mandate that.
Of the dangerous dog ordinance was one that I had heard from law enforcement requesting clarification on, so they knew when they could and couldn't intervene when they're, because we've had some pretty serious dangerous dog incidences. And I think that's been updated in this code.
I don't know that that's changed all that much or how that would help, what changes have been made and how that would help them. But maybe, yes. And I know that that's been a recent problem.
Yeah, I guess I'm just attentive to.
And how are we going to do the kennel licenses?
It's provided here in that it happens through the sheriff's office. with the animal enforcement officer as the sheriff's representative on that.
Well, they, we right now, dog licensing takes place at the GSA level, doesn't it?
Yep.
Right.
Dog licensing is just tags are sold by the treasurer.
Yeah, but GSA isn't.
So the contract. Kennel licensing will happen through the sheriff's office, yeah. Then totally separate from animal licensing. Well,
dog license should go to sheriff too. Then licenses should go there.
Probably should.
Well, maybe, but when you get a dog license, all you do is come in and say, I have a dog and it has been rabies vaccinated. I'd like to get a dog tag. I'd like to get a license.
Right. But why wouldn't animal control want to oversee the entire process?
Well, I can only say because the sheriff didn't ask for that to happen. It's a transaction. It's not a request to be able to have a dog. It's a transaction saying, I have a dog. I'd like my tag for my dog. I think that's the difference. Whereas the kenneling situation is, I would like government sign off on my having this many dogs, either for commercial purposes or for private purposes. It's different than just saying I have a dog. I'd like to get my tag. I think that's why it never came up.
We do that with guns. I have a gun. I want to get my license.
Yes, we
want to keep track of where they're at. Mm-hmm. Right? Is this about tracking where animals are at? Who has how many?
Well, it's also about making sure that they have their rabies vaccinations. Well, that's the other part of it.
Good questions to have at the public hearing.
True. I do have one question, though, that's for us, really. So it used to say on 6.08.060, which is on page 55, the lost dog identification tag may be replaced by substitute identification tags upon payment of $1 to Island County is what it used to say. Now it says of a payment of a fee established by resolution of the Board of Island County Commissioners. Are there any other places in here that the Board of Island County Commissioners has to do a resolution? And if so, can we just stick all of them together? Or maybe that's in the resolution that we're adopting.
Well, I like it having not bound by a dollar amount in the code so that we just change fees.
Yeah, so fees are, all the fees in here are that way, as a fee established from time to time by the Board of County Commissioners, so that in the adoption of a unified fee schedule, which we'll be doing next year,
we'll do it when we will be.
Okay. That's literally, I have given a note to Susan, when you're tracking the planning and building and other fees for the unified fee schedule, be sure to include private kennel, commercial kennel, and dog license and replacement tag. Okay. Because that way you uncouple them. You take the fees out of the code because you don't want to do an ordinance to change $1 to $2. No. That's a big waste of energy. So right. You do it once a year and you say, oh, it's time to update these fees.
Okay. So it'll be included when we see that next year.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you want to be able to have the fee, like the day that this goes into effect, then we need to do an ordinance with it, but it's planned to happen.
No, we already have an adopted fee schedule. All you did was uncouple the fee schedule. We have a fee schedule for licensing and lost tags, and we can update that at some point in time. It's not eliminating it. It's just saying we're uncoupling the fee from the ordinance.
I honestly don't know if it's in the fee schedule because it's in the code, and that's all that was mattering to me at the time.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm good with scheduling the public hearing.
Me too.
Then there you have it.
Jill?
Any other questions I can try to answer?
Or do we need to pull that off consent?
I mean, you can schedule the public hearing.
And that's what would go to consent, would be the scheduling of the public hearing. Yeah, not this code. Okay.
Goes to consent on this.
Can we ask if Greg can have somebody there to answer questions about what this means and does not mean? I know he gets uncomfortable doing that, but you know what I get uncomfortable doing? Passing code, which I don't understand the ramifications of because legal doesn't explain it to me. I kind of think that's their job a little bit. I'm not trying to be harsh. I just need them to say what we get from it. What is the consequence of this? That's what I'm trying to make sure I'm really clear on. What do I get? When I say I, what does the public get?
And I can
also prepare that as part of the presentation of the public hearing on these. This is.
I mean, maybe he can help you on a memo or something.
I don't think he's going to want to come and answer that question.
I know. I'm respectful of that, and I'm not trying to put him on the spot. But it is really, really difficult as a policymaker to have public conversations about policy and then get legal critique after the fact, right? Like, it sets us up to do it wrong. And what I'm asking for is partnership development on how do we get to the outcomes that the community wants. He's elected to serve the community just as much as we are. I don't understand in policy development why we can't have legal participation to say, if you do this, it means this. And that's what I want to know.
And this may be an exception to that situation, because I will say that the PA and the sheriff both were very actively involved in developing this code. We met routinely. Mm-hmm. We edited together. They reviewed drafts and suggested changes. So he did do that at a staff level with me in moving it forward. I think it doesn't answer all your questions, but I do want you to know I didn't create this sort of shock in the dark and hope Greg was okay. He was very involved. There are some things that honestly he said, this isn't really going to create more enforcement capacity because we have this ability now. But if it helps clarify things for the public, it doesn't hurt.
I guess that's what I want to have clear is realistic expectations for outcome associated with it on the enforcement side. I also, the other piece I'm going to need is any cost increase associated with this. So are there additional, I don't want to do this and then have somebody come a year later saying, I need this much additional staff support for the program. We have the capacity to deliver this with our existing staff or?
With the existing budgeted positions, because you, as a board, have already increased from 1.5 to 2, and the sheriff said that's what's needed.
Let's be sure that if we can convince Greg to come, I think that's a good question, and then have the sheriff be at the public hearing when we debate this or discuss this.
I will make sure they both get invitations, and we'll ask them to attend.
Again, I'm not trying to put him on the spot. I'm not a lawyer. And this is really about standards that could lead to people, you know, what happens if they don't meet these standards? What is that process? What is this justifiable? If somebody challenged it, is it defensible? I mean, that is where I just feel like we are vulnerable because we do not talk with him about that or anyone on the development of policy documents that are regulatory. I feel like we're just hanging out there.
I would say, I think this is an exception to that rule, which it is a rule kind of that doesn't happen. But unlike, say, for example, if you were doing zoning code, they're not sitting down with the PA in the room saying, should we change this? How about this? What do you think about this addition? That did happen with this.
They don't even get there until they're the code reviser and they look at the final product. Right. They're not part of the process that got to but in this case, they were.
They were.
Okay.
It's a little, definitely a bit different than the norm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're okay on time. Any other questions? Okay. Then the board will reconvene for 2 executive sessions today. 1:00 is allowed under RCW 4230101G to evaluate the qualifications of an applicant for public employment. Executive session will occur in the admin building room 116 and is expected to last approximately 1 hour with no announcements anticipated. At 2:30 p.m. is allowed under RCW 42, the same one, to review the performance of a public employee. The executive session, the second one, will occur in the admin building room 116, expected to last approximately 90 minutes with no announcement anticipated. There is no further business of this meeting, so we are adjourned until 1 p.m. when we will reconvene for executive session.
If you don't, this is on.